This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, initiating an oral history interview with Thomas Powers of the U.S. Marine Corps. Today's date is the 2nd of June, 2004, and both Tom and I are here in the Special Collections Building in the Formby Room, conducting the interview on the campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I want to start by asking you some general biographical questions. First of all, where were you born and when?
I was born in Dayton, Ohio, February the 1st, 1945.
Can you tell me a little bit about your dad? Did, for example, he have service during World War II? Or?
My father was in the Marines during World War II. He did not leave the United States. I asked him what he did in the war one time, and he said, I knocked out one sailor a week in the special services. I boxed.
He was a boxer?
He was a boxer, undefeated.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Had he been boxing before he went into the Marines?
I don't know. I don't think so. He was a football player at the University of Dayton. And then he got transferred to Penn State, where he also lettered in football in some kind of military thing during the war. And that's where he met my mother at Penn State.
Okay. And so your mom was a student there as well?
My mother's a graduate of Penn State.
Okay. So we got a couple Nittany Lions in the background there.
Well, my dad went back and graduated from University of Dayton.
Okay.
So he's a flyer.
Tell me a little bit, first of all, if you can, about your dad's background. Was he an Ohioan by birth?
Yes, my father was also born in Dayton. He had two brothers, I think three sisters, and there was a brother that died as an infant. Working class family.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first from his family to go to college, and he only got to go because he had a football scholarship.
What did he study, Tom, when he went to school?
Sociology. He ended up being chief of the adult probation department in Butler County, Ohio.
Okay. And did he stay there for most of his career?
Yes. He started out as a teacher, mm-hmm. then switched to probation. And after he retired, he went back to teaching again.
At high school level, or...?
His original teaching was high school level, where he coached also.
Uh-huh.
When he went back, he taught at the juvenile detention center.
And tell me about his coaching. Was it more than one sport, or...?
He coached basketball once and football at Hamel Catholic High School.
Did he like doing that?
I think so. He taught algebra.
He had a lot of interests.
Yeah. I think he started the probation department in Butler County.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first probation officer. And he was chief when he retired. And there's a plaque. He's deceased. He died mm-hmm. in 86. There's a plaque in the Butler County Courthouse dedicated to him.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because he had innovated the probation program?
Yeah, he spent a long time trying to keep people out of prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about your mom? She was a college student when he met her.
Yeah, she graduated, and she was a kindergarten teacher,
mm-hmm.
finally.
What was her name, her maiden name?
Sarah Piolet, anglicized now, they call it Piolet.
How did she spell that?
P-I-O-L-L-E-T. It's a French name.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. She... I think majored in Spanish in college, but she said that she doesn't remember much of it. She's still alive.
Is she?
Uh-huh. 82.
Mm-hmm.
Or will be 82 in September.
And where
or
is
October.
She,
September
where is she
27.
Living?
Lives in Hamilton, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
In a retirement-type environment.
Okay. How was it that she came to go to Penn State, do you know? Was she born near there?
She was... she and her three sisters... were raised by their mother. Her father, my grandfather, her father died when she was 15.
Uh-huh.
During the Depression, they lost the family home and the whole works. And
mm-hmm.
my grandmother, who died in 92, I guess she was 94 years old, she was a registered nurse and was the school nurse in the small town in northeast Pennsylvania, Towanda.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know that?
Mm-hmm, sure. I've been through there.
In Bradford County. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, my mother was born and raised there. That Wysox, which is right across the Susquehanna River there.
Mm-hmm.
And she raised them, and three of them went to college. They're all very bright, all four sisters. My mother has a master's degree, too, from Miami, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And my father has had a master's degree from Xavier University. And my brother has one. I'm the only one that doesn't have a master's degree.
Well, there's always time. You can always go back.
Yeah,
education is a lifelong thing, right?
Right.
It's interesting that your mom had both two sisters and herself all going to college. You know, in that time period, it's unusual.
Yeah. Well, her one sister, my aunt Joan, graduated from Penn State at age 19, Phi Beta Kappa.
Wow.
And I can't remember where Aunt Joyce went. She's deceased. I think Ryder College, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And my Aunt Cynthia married very young and didn't. But she's a very well-educated, self-educated
mm-hmm.
woman.
Mm-hmm. They sound like a bright group of girls.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And my grandmother was quite a... She was something.
She must have been.
Yeah.
With four girls and
of course, my grandfather, who died, was a Penn State graduate. So
is that right?
I'm third. I guess I'm a third-generation college graduate
mm-hmm.
on that side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in fact, there's a student society at Penn State that was founded by my grandfather.
Do you know which one?
It's called Parmi Nu.
Okay. Is it like a Greek? Or
no, it's a... an honorary type thing. I joke about how it belongs to it.
Okay.
Means it's French. I think it means among us. Parmi nous. And he founded that.
And it's sort of a spirit, kind of a spirit organization?
Yeah, I don't even know. Yeah, it still exists. It's now co-ed, of course.
Sure.
It wasn't at first.
Uh-huh.
It was men.
Was he there then in the 20s? Or
much earlier.
Earlier.
Because he was 50 when he died in 1938. So, I want to say 02 to 06 or 03 to 07,
wow.
Somewhere around there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Any photos of him or that time period?
I have a photo. We have a photo of him, but there's not much.
Mm-hmm.
There's more photos of the girls, the sisters. In fact, we're going to a family reunion in the end of July.
Where is that going to be? Up in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, up in Twan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, last year or the
Beautiful.
Year before now.
Well, it's a good time to think back over, you know, these... family links and look back over the photos. Tom, tell me about growing up. I imagine that you did grow up in Dayton.
No.
Nearby.
My dad took the job in Hamilton.
Okay.
My first year or two were in Dayton, but I remember very little about it except I know where the apartments are. And they're still there, and there's still people living in them, but they're terrible.
Is that right? Is that
it's
right?
It's a really bad section of town.
Mm-hmm.
And but he took the job in Hamilton, and we lived in a part of a house right next to Hamilton Catholic High School, which where he taught. I remember some of that, and I remember... that the house really wasn't set up for two families, so there was no door going upstairs.
How'd you get up there then?
Well, I mean, there was an opening, but there wasn't any locked door.
Oh, right.
You
no.
just went up the stairs and you had to count on the people downstairs not coming up to see you. You know? And,
I see.
My mom said she came home one day and one of the priests from the high school was standing at the kitchen window looking at the kids out on the playground, probably trying to, you know, catch somebody doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So people just walked in, you know.
Well, is that the high school that you ended up going to?
No, my mother and father decided to send me down to Cincinnati, D. to Xavier High School, which was mm-hmm. a Jesuit school mm-hmm. in Cincinnati.
Why did they make that decision? I mean,
it
can I ask?
It was a real good college prep school. It had a uh-huh. great reputation. And some of my mother's friends sent their children there, so I guess.
Okay. Now, did you have brothers and sisters?
I have one brother, younger, Tim.
Okay. How much younger is Tim than you?
20. He was born in November of 46, so that okay. that's, what, 18, 20
yeah,
months.
A year and a half behind you. Did he also go down to
He went
Xavier?
There for a couple of years, and then he transferred back to Hamilton.
Now, when you were going to high school down there, did you live down there as well, or how did that work?
No, there were, well, my senior year, there were 22 kids going from Hamilton to Cincinnati. It was about a 20-some-mile drive, mm-hmm. and we carpooled. And okay. the people who rode paid 40 cents a way. I remember that one way. So
wow.
my junior and senior year, I drove my mom and dad's car and gave them, they got the money, you know.
Oh, okay. So you're like running a bus service, basically.
Yeah. And probably unbeknownst to the insurance guy.
I'm sure.
My freshman year, it was in downtown Cincinnati. And if I got jugged and missed my ride, mm-hmm. jug is what they call detention in Jesuit schools.
Okay.
I'd have to ride the Ohio bus lines, get to catch the bus and ride to downtown Hamilton and then walk out to the west side, which was a good 6 or 8 miles.
So there's a disincentive for acting up. And
yeah, didn't work all the time.
Okay.
And then they moved closer. They built a new school, which still exists today, out in Finneytown, which is a suburb of Cincinnati, which is closer to Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Much nicer school. And the last 3 years were there.
Okay. Now, Tom, did you play sports in high school at all?
I sat the bench a year in baseball one mm-hmm. year. But, I played a lot of baseball when I was a kid, but it was hard to manage to play sports if you were from... had to drive 20-some miles to school.
Yeah, because practices would be
yeah,
after
and
school.
Yeah, you lose your ride home. And, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of those things. I liked baseball, but I wasn't really all that good. And
what about football? Did you
No, I didn't.
Think of
my
that?
Brother. My brother played football. He was an honorable mention All-State when he was in high school.
Is that right? What positions was he playing?
And he played, I guess, what they now call a tight end or something, you know. Players weren't quite as big when we were
right. Yeah.
playing.
Yeah, that's right.
And my father played 2 sports in college. My mother and her sisters can barely chew gum and walk.
The coordination's not coming. The brains are coming from that side, but not
right,
the coordination.
That's, yeah, okay. They're all smart.
Well, what year did you end up graduating from
high school?
Xavier?
1963. Just had our 40th reunion last year.
And did you go?
Oh yeah.
How was that? Was it a good experience?
Oh yeah. I started going at the 20th one.
Uh-huh.
Before that, high school is pretty hard, I think, the social business. But I went back to the 20th and found out everybody'd grown up. So,
mm-hmm.
you know,
so it was a little easier to...
Yeah, everybody was glad to see you, you know. So I kept going after that.
Okay, okay. Do you consider some of those people still your friends?
Some of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. Four of us met actually before the reunion to have a beer.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 of them I don't see very often. The other one I see every once in a while. But we made a pact that we were going to get together this summer and go to a ball game or something. But one of them I went to grade school with.
Oh, really? So that's a long time.
Worked at his father's root beer stand, you know, when I was in high school.
Wow. In the fall of 1963, of course, the president was assassinated. Do you remember that?
Yes.
What do you remember about it? Where were you?
I went 1 year of college before Vietnam at University of Dayton, where my father went.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming out of Mrs. Stockham's English class, English composition, when I found out about it. I remember that very well.
What was the What was the feeling? How did you feel? What was the response?
I felt terrible. I thought that's the kind of thing that happens in banana republics, you know. And I liked him, even, you know. My father and mother tended toward Republican.
Mm-hmm.
But we liked Kennedy.
Would you say that that other young men and women your age, you know, at the university, you know, even politics aside, were stunned? Were they in disbelief, or were they angry?
Yeah. Well, I didn't see a lot of anger. Uh-huh. I saw mostly disbelief. That kind of thing didn't occur to us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when was the last president assassinated before that?
Around
the turn of the century, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Teddy Roosevelt got to be president, mm-hmm. wasn't it? Yeah, I remember some people visiting the chapel, praying. But it passed, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch on TV? Did you have access to TV there?
I'm trying to think. This was long before the days of TVs in your room.
You know, For sure. Yeah.
You know, we had no TV in the room. It was a dorm.
Yeah.
And seems to me there was a TV in a rec room or something that maybe we...
Student lounge or something like that.
Yeah.
Hmm. Tom... You were at the University of Dayton for just a year at that point, and what happened such that you didn't go back?
I really wasn't ready to go. I didn't do that well. I was still in good standing, but my parents were not completely happy with my performance.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So they said, basically, you can pay for it yourself. So... I started going to school at night down at Xavier, and I worked. I worked at the local Pepsi Cola plant.
What'd you do?
I was a truck checker.
What does that mean?
That meant that I counted the Pepsi products when they came in. They matched them up against what they took out, and they better have the money for the difference.
Oh, I see. Auditing. Hmm.
Yeah. Eventually, I was the cashier, and I took the money.
And how long did you stay there?
Ah, geez. November of 1964, I moved to a life insurance company to become a computer operator.
Really? Tell me about the computers that you would be working with.
The early IBM computers, 1401 and 7070. A lot of those old... card interpreters and card
mm-hmm.
sorters.
Yep. Were you? How did you get that job?
Was it something? Answered an ad in the paper.
Really? No training required, or?
Yeah, they would train you. They didn't pay you much. They better train you.
Yeah.
And back in those days, that's and it's a good thing, because otherwise, history majors. You know, it's a good place for them.
I absolutely know what you're talking about. Was that something that you thought might be what you'd like to do? Work with computers? Or?
Yeah, and within 6 months I was programming computers.
In what language would...
Then it was AutoCoder, it was called.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It was an assembler language for 1401.
Uh-huh.
In fact, when that Florida vote thing, I know all about those punch cards. I could told you I know what a hanging chad is. I know what all that stuff is.
I voted that ballot, actually.
Oh, yeah. Butler County, uh-huh. Ohio uses those same machines.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Those. I lived in Palm Beach County and voted that ballot. It was a little problematical. But so hanging chad and all that, was that the terminology you would use, too? Are those little punch-outs called a chad?
Well, they were called chads. Yeah, there's
no
a
kidding.
Bucket. There was a bucket inside the card punches uh-huh. that collected them, and you had to empty it. A light would come on the outside.
Seriously?
Say, it's time to empty the chad. You take it and pour it in the garbage.
That's interesting.
And if, yeah, the card readers, now they, I'm sure they use lasers now, but back then they were brushes, and the card would go between these brushes, and where the brushes touched, that meant there's a hole there.
Yes. It would, the signal.
And, yeah, and it would go through two positions like that and compare, you know. And I'm sure now they use a light, which makes a lot, you know. But back then it was brushes. But I knew all about this. I even offered my opinion by email with some people. During the recount was, when the first recount, you know, I said, I was thinking, why is he recounting places where he won? And then the light bulb went off. I said, I know what they're up to. When I pull my cards out, when I vote, I always look at them to make sure. There's nothing hanging there. Smack them off and turn them in.
Well, out of interest, is your county? Did your county get new machines?
I just voted this spring on those same machines.
No kidding.
So I don't know if they're planning to have new ones by the election or not.
The last time,
it's
I
a little late. You know?
Yeah, this is the next election. It's imminent. That's interesting. So you thought you might stay with computers? Was it the computer part of it rather than the insurance part of it then that was of interest?
Yeah, the programming is what I like.
And how long did you stay there?
Until I enlisted. And I left there in March of 66.
Why did you leave?
I was going to get drafted.
And so was enlistment a way of... What was your
thinking? I was in. It was in November. I was in the middle of a semester at night. You know,
yeah,
I was taking 9 hours, three courses.
Mm-hmm.
And I got reclassified to 1A. And I thought, geez, if I get drafted out of this semester, I'll lose all this work. So I went down to the Marine guy, and they gave me a 120-day delay. They let me enlist, which got the draft board off my back. And then I had to go in March.
So you finished your term.
I finished the term, got 9 more hours, and then.
Now, do you remember going to the recruiting office?
Yeah, first time I went with my dad. He took me down there. I wish I could remember that guy's name. It was at the post office in Hamilton, upstairs. It was a gunnery sergeant, and I can't think of his name.
Was he a good guy?
Yeah, you know, he wanted to make his numbers.
Sure.
To get me in there.
Sure.
And he knew my dad was his ally. You know, he wanted him to.
Now, did your dad influence your choice of the Marine Corps because of his own service?
Yeah, plus the 120-day delay.
You couldn't probably swing that with...
I couldn't swing it with the Army. You never drafted people. What do they need to give people delayed?
Had you actually spoken to anyone in the Army, or you were just reading this... What was in the air? You knew that.
I knew what was going on. I called the National Guard and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But they got waiting lists a mile long.
Right.
It's either get married or you're on your way. And I know some people that got married, but I was too young for that, I guess.
Were you anxious about entering the Marine Corps?
Yeah, a little. I was a little worried about that boot camp because I really had been sitting around for a couple of years, you know, desk job.
So the PT part was a little bit of a worry?
Yeah.
How'd you actually do with that?
They gave you a test when you got there to see if you were good enough to go to boot camp. And if you weren't, they put you in this physical conditioning place until you were good enough.
Right.
I passed. So, not by a lot. But by more than a nose. You know?
Okay.
And by the time 9 weeks were up, I had way more than doubled my score. So
they
did okay.
They worked
pretty hard. It was very difficult for me. And there were guys who were just out of high school when they were, who were 3 years younger.
Sure.
Had been doing something. It was very difficult. It wasn't until probably 6 weeks in. I did really well at the rifle range, which gave me a boost, you know, in the eyes of the drill instructor.
Mm-hmm.
The bad thing to do is let them find out your name. or do anything to distinguish you, yourself, either good or bad. And I finished first on the tests, the written tests we took.
Whoops.
So after any time I made a mistake, if you're so smart, how come you can't march?
Tom, where was boot camp?
San Diego.
At Pendleton? Or
no, it's the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. It's okay. Right next to the Navy boot camp and right next to the San Diego airport.
And you were there 9 weeks? Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right.
When did you actually graduate from boot camp? Do you remember what month it was?
Ooh, March, April, May. It must have been June.
Okay. Had any of the DIs that you came across had experience in Vietnam, do you know?
Yes.
Did they talk about it at all? Or
yes.
What did you learn from them about it?
In the drill, that we had to pay attention and do our stuff, and there was a reason for these obstacles in the obstacle course. And if you don't go over that, I can remember one guy saying, they got these things, you know, you got to do this because you're going to run into that type of stuff
sure.
over in the jungle, you know. And all in all, they were pretty good, although I think there's a streak of nastiness in them sometimes. They could be pretty inventive when it came to punishment. And usually it's group punishment, you know, the whole bunch.
Do you remember any incidents that you could tell us about that?
Oh, I remember at the rifle range. Well, you go back then, you went for 2 weeks to the rifle range. I think now they go longer than that. And we weren't marching right. And he just said, stop. Not halt or anything like that. He said, stop. So we stopped. And he said, okay, who's from Oklahoma or Texas? And he got a couple guys from Texas or Oklahoma. He said, all right, you guys are cowboys. And he had the rest of us walk with our heads down and moo while these guys ran around the platoon like they had ropes, you know, and hooping and hollering.
God.
Like we were cattle, not, we couldn't do any better than that. And that wasn't particularly painful. They did stuff that was really hard sometimes, too. I remember when I graduated, my hand was infected from doing squat thrusts on the concrete. You know, I had broken blisters open. And
no kidding.
I spent the night before. The drill instructor was, you know, if guys flunk, it's not good for them.
At all, yeah.
Night before, one of the drill instructors, this is the night before our final test, had me up with my hand in warm Epsom salts, you know. And he was taking care of my hand so I could do the pull-ups, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rest of it I could tough out, but the pull-ups he was worried about.
He wanted to get you through that.
And I got through, fair and square.
Now, from there, did you go to advanced training?
Yeah, we went to Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
To wait for a slot in the infantry training, which every Marine took back then. I'm sure they do it now.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent 2 weeks on mess duty in a mess hall, working in a mess hall. And I spent those 2 weeks working in the spud locker, as they call it. The potato peeling apparatus. And
this actually happened. This isn't just a...
No, I actually did
a,
this.
A tale.
They... because often you had to wait till a class started. So they had to do something. So the whole bunch of us were in there. And I got these big tubs full of potatoes in water. And our job was to peel them, put them in these other tubs with water, and get the eyes out, you know. But fortunately, they had a machine, which was a rotating drum with like sandpaper on the inside. And water would come through this thing. You throw the potatoes in there.
Scrub them. Basically.
Let them scrub the skins off,
yep.
And then you shut it off, open the door, and out they plopped into your other bin.
Uh-huh.
Well, when they plopped out, you had to get the eyes out. Well, I soon discovered that if you left them in there a little longer,
eventually
you got smaller potatoes, but you didn't have any eyes. This was wasting government money hand over fist. But eventually we got caught doing that. And they told us to knock that off.
Uh-huh.
And because we were getting these marble-sized potatoes.
Were there any consequences for you experimenting with?
No, they just yelled at us. You know, we were out of boot camp at that point. And it was some guy that wasn't, you know, some corporal or sergeant that wasn't the big boss. He's not back there fooling with the spud locker guys.
Did you eventually get assigned to an infantry training?
Yes.
Position?
Yeah. We had 2 weeks, it seems to me, of infantry training.
And was that at Pendleton? Or?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
At a place called Santa Margarita, I think, which is one of the camps there. I think that's where it was. And we did our thing there. That's where I got to visit. I got a visit from a college friend of my father's, who was a colonel.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, this was really... in fact, he was the commanding officer of the 26th Marine Regiment. They were at Camp Pendleton right then. His name was Padley, I remember that. John Padley, or Jack Padley, my dad called him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know this was going to happen, but his staff car pulls up with the colonel and the regimental sergeant major. And they asked the troop leaders to see, they want to see me, right? So this was in the morning before we headed out. And they sat down and talked to me, and they brought them donuts and coffee, which they gave to me, which was really nice because I hadn't had a donut in a long time. Talked to me and told me my dad had written him and said, go check my, see how my son's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me if I wanted to be in the 26th Marine Regiment. And I said, I'm going to let fate take its course. If I show up there, fine. If I don't, but, you know.
Why did you give that answer?
I was afraid to pick.
Really?
You know, if you pick it, it's sort of your fault if you get your ass shot.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I figured wherever I'm supposed to be, I'll end up there. Hmm. It was sort of a... because at that point I had the right MOS. My MOS was 1800 at that point, which was a general track vehicle thing. Mm-hmm. I could have gone to Amtrak's, which would have fit the 26 Marines or tanks.
Okay.
And I ended up then going to tank school at Camp Pendleton after infantry school.
And how long did tank school last?
Oh, gee.
Any idea?
Oh, several weeks it seemed.
Uh-huh. Right.
It was at a place called Del Mar in Camp Hill.
Okay.
And it was on the beach. And we did get a tank stuck out there. They have these big things they call tank retrievers that kind of yank them out, you know.
And, if they get in too deep, if the tracks get buried or...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove them around, and we went into other parts of Camp Pendleton and shot the guns. And had classroom stuff on how it all worked.
During this advanced training, were you given to understand that you would be going to Vietnam?
Oh, they never said... they never said that. The general feeling was you're all going eventually, but they never said you're going after this class or you're all going eventually.
Okay. Was there chatter amongst the guys in your training units about Vietnam and what it must be like? Or apprehension or or not?
I had I don't remember much about that. I remember we had more immediate concerns, you know, getting out to the beach or passing the tests in the class, field day in the barracks, you know, cleaning the barracks. I remember about that time, one of the things that stuck in my mind was church on Sunday. They always sang the sailor's hymn at the end. And I've always liked that. Yeah. And the next time I heard it, or one of the next time, I was working down in Cincinnati. This was when the Marines were blown up over Beirut, Lebanon, mm-hmm. Beirut.
Like about 1982, something like that.
One of the churches down there on their chimes was playing the sailor's hymn that day. Mm-hmm. And it just took me back to that. Next.
I was wondering if you went to church quite regularly during the training. And
well, we...
Was it something
in boot camp, we sure did, because you'd get away from those drill instructors
mm-hmm.
for a while.
Yeah.
I grew up going to church every week, and I don't go now, but... it really was after Vietnam. I didn't go much anymore. Mm-hmm. I probably only went a couple times over there. They had a chaplain come and do the mass off the back of the Jeep.
Right.
And I remember that.
Tom, when did you get your posting for your next placement after advanced, after tank school?
At the end of tank school, they gave you orders.
Okay.
And my orders were to Camp Lejeune.
Okay.
2nd Tank Battalion.
And do you remember going out east for that?
Yeah, I went home on the way. And mm-hmm. Then went to Camp Lejeune.
What did your dad think about you showing up as a Marine at this point?
I'm not sure. I think they were proud of me, and he probably figured, boy, how in the heck did you get, how did you make it? Because I was, you know, boot camp for me was just wrenching. I mean, you know, you talk about a change of life. Because I was pretty much do as I please, you know. Boot camp was very, very hard. And not as... Even harder mentally than physically.
The adjustment to all the discipline and
all the,
up in your face and
the discipline and everybody and being treated exactly like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I don't know how that sounds, but I thought that I was above average.
That's fair.
And I was average there.
Right. Everyone was average.
Right.
That's all there was average. Yeah. What did you find on your arrival at Camp Lejeune? What was the camp like, and where were you placed, and what did you do?
I don't remember the exact location of the 2nd Tank Battalion had a place. When we first got there, it was on a weekend, I think, but the first sergeant took a look at us and said, boy, what a bunch of candidates for a haircut. Because I'd been home for like... Mm-hmm. And they had the barbers ready. You know, we went over to the barber shop, and I can remember it was a barber shop where they would cut your hair the way you wanted it. I mean, or not a boot camp barber shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the guy saying, well, how short do you want it? I said, see that guy? If he sends me back in here, you're in trouble. I said, you cut it as short as he wants it. So I got my hair cut. And then the next day we got checked in. And we were in a barracks where you had bunks mm-hmm. and lockers. And brick building. I think we were up on the second floor. And there was a captain in charge of our... We were in a... Not many people know this, but at that time, all the armed forces of the United States, our Army had were medium, what they call medium tanks, was the biggest thing we had, which was an M60.
Mm-hmm.
We had M48s for most of the 2nd Tank Battalion, but C Company had M104, but I'm not positive. It was a heavy tank. It was a 62-ton thing with a 120-millimeter gun. It, obsolete, you know, just like the M48 was. The mm-hmm. Army had M60s already. You know, with the mechanical computer, ballistic computer for firing solutions and all that. And that company rotated a platoon of tanks down to Guantanamo every 3 months.
Okay.
To guard the heavy tanks.
Right.
But anyway, I was in those heavy tanks. They had an extra man on a crew. They had two loaders because you had a two-piece round. You had to put the projectile in and then put the brass with the powder in it. And so you had two loaders. It was a big tank. And I never saw them after that. I think they must have disappeared in the
mm-hmm.
dustbin.
Mm-hmm.
But
what was the number again, do you think?
It might have been M104.
Okay.
But I'm not positive.
Okay. We can look it up.
Right.
Yeah. But did you ever get rotated down to Guantanamo Bay?
I was supposed to go the next month, but I got orders to Vietnam instead.
When did those come to you, those orders?
Must have been late November of 66. Or maybe early December.
And how long did you have to report? Did you
well,
get a
I had
a
little
or?
Leave left.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Which was a little... I had an argument about this, too, because I was in for 2 years, so I'd get 60 days leave, right?
Right.
But they'd only give you leave you'd accrued. So I was going to go off to Vietnam. I'd only get to go home for about 10 days because that's all I had left accrued at that point.
Right. You had
even though when I came back, I was going to get out and I wouldn't get it.
You couldn't spend it. Sort of catch 22 kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, so I went home before Christmas.
Okay.
And left for California before Christmas to what they call staging battalion.
Mm-hmm. And where was that? Was that down in Pendleton as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Camp Pendleton.
Uh-huh. How long were you there?
I'm not sure. A couple weeks, maybe.
Okay.
We did a lot of the stuff we did in infantry training. We did in staging battalion. We fired everything conceivable. Stuff from World War II, even, you know, mm-hmm. Browning automatic rifles. Because I think the South Vietnamese had them. Browning automatic rifles and M1 carbines and those silly... grease guns, those 45 caliber submachine guns, M3s, I think, M3A1 or something. And
you were going through the whole arsenal.
We fired M1s. We fired, and we were carrying M14s at that point.
Okay, so. And later on, I'm sure you had the M16 at some stage.
Summer 67.
Okay.
When I was in Vietnam.
And just to step out of the chronological pattern for a second, Tom, thinking about the M14, the M16, can you compare the two and which one did you prefer?
I qualified with the M14 as an expert, so I was really
happy with that one.
I was really comfortable with it. And when they took them away, we were in Vietnam and we were given M16s. We only fired them for familiarization. We didn't really have a rifle range or anything like that. They were lighter, could carry more ammo, mm-hmm. but for an artillery guy, that wasn't all that important. And we didn't have any of the jamming problems because we weren't out in the mud, you know.
Yeah.
But I just figured, you know, by that time I was rolling with the punches. You know? Mm-hmm. Take my rifle, all right.
Yeah.
Give me another one.
So you didn't keep back your M14? You went ahead and
changed
it in?
Oh, yeah. They took them. They didn't get any choice.
Okay.
The funny part was the staff, the sergeants, trying to figure out how we were going to do inspection arms with a M16. That was amusing. I don't know what we did, to tell you the truth.
Well, Tom, you had that few days off before you had to report to Camp Pendleton again, and I think I heard you say that you went home. And at this point, of course, your parents know that you have orders for Vietnam.
Yeah, I called them from Camp Lejeune. That was a hard phone call.
Yeah. I was going to ask about their reaction.
Well, my mother was... both of them were upset, but it was like a duty to them. They, you know, you had to go. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
My mother told me... And my dad never told me this. My dad went to Mass every day I was gone in Vietnam.
No kidding.
Huh. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Did she go as well?
No, I don't think so. Not every day. I'm sure she didn't. Huh. She had to get up early and go to school. My dad really didn't have to be work till 9, you know.
Well, I'm sure he wasn't. He was doing it for a purpose other than killing time. He was obviously...
Yeah, he was
thinking
there.
About you.
Yeah.
And because of his own service, although he wasn't posted overseas, had some sense,
yeah.
Probably.
When you think about how people worry today, I know we have friends who have a son over in Baghdad, and they're worried sick. And yeah. When I think back that 15 or 20 people were getting killed every day.
Yes.
And my mother and father had to wonder every day when they heard that.
Yeah. And there was no email. There was no...
Right.
You know, video links and all the
rest.
They
could talk to him on the phone.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's hard from this time to think back on how difficult communications were at that point. And maybe it's something we can talk about when we talk about being in country. Your go ahead, Don. Were you thinking of something?
No, go ahead.
Your departure from Pendleton to Vietnam, how was that arranged? Did you leave directly from there?
I think we left from El Toro.
Okay.
And it was a charter.
Uh-huh.
I think Continental Airlines. We went to Hawaii. Changed planes. And I'm trying to think. Then we flew to Okinawa, I guess.
And would this have been after the first of the year?
Yes.
So very early.
Because I arrived there. Yeah, I spent Christmas in California. I arrived, I think, in Vietnam on the 12th or 13th of January.
Tommy said it was a charter. Do you remember the mood on that plane?
No, I don't. I don't think anybody... I don't remember anything.
Okay.
I remember my mood leaving Cincinnati when I went to California. I remember getting on that plane. My mother couldn't go to the airport. She just couldn't do it. And my father and brother went.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all right. I was on the plane. I started thinking that I may have seen them for the last time. Or they may have seen me for the last
right.
time. It's probably a better way to look at it.
Right.
And that was a sad moment. I was really, really upset about that.
Did you have concerns, Tom, about your brother? He was just 18 months younger. What was he doing in terms of dealing
with... He was in college at that point.
Okay.
We can get to him if you want to after.
Sure.
It's out of order.
That's okay. Go ahead and tell me now while we're thinking about it.
Okay. He got drafted after I got back.
Really?
And my mother said, I just can't do this again. She wrote our congressman and said, you got to do something about this. I've already sent one over there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done with this. And I can't remember who the congressman was then. It's John Boehner's district now, but he wasn't. That was a long time ago.
Right.
Because he's my age. Might have been Tom Kindness, but I'm not possible. I'm not sure. But anyway, he wrote back and said, really, you know, there's not anything I can do about this.
Right.
But my brother ended up handing out basketballs at Fort Leonard Wood and playing on the 4th Army softball team, fast pitch softball. Then he was transferred to some really tough duty. He was a lifeguard at the dependent swimming pool in at Sandia Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Any idea how he managed to get those placements?
I don't know. I've always suspected that the congressman had to say he couldn't do anything, but that he called in an IOU someplace. That's what I suspect.
Okay.
And that's perfectly okay with me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine having to worry about that again. Yeah, we flew from Okinawa on a C-130 from Kadena, I think is the name of the airbase.
Mm-hmm.
And we landed at Da Nang. It was night. And I remember when they lowered the gizmo at the back. Technical term.
That's okay.
Seeing the illumination flares. And the guy on the... on the ground, the ground crew guy was saying, okay, get your stuff, get out of here fast, run over here, you know. And I never knew whether he was just messing with us or whether there was something going on, you know. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They put us in a transient area and finally said, well, you're going up to the 12th Marines at Dong Ha. 12th Marines. So what's that? You know, we didn't know for sure.
Right.
It's artillery. All right. Artillery, but we're tank guys. You know, there was about 7 or 8 of us from 2nd Tanks. So we went up to Dong Ha, and you call from the airport, you know, getting a little, you know, come and get us, you know. So they come and get us, and we go over to the thing and check in, and they don't know what the hell we're doing there because we're tank crew.
Right.
And I remember sitting in a tent with a guy from the 12th Marines having a Crown beer. I think it was Crown. It was Korean.
Okay.
It was Korean beer, and I remember reading on the side of the can, best beer in Korea. And I was wondering, what exactly does that mean?
Right. What other beers are there in Korea?
Yeah. Compared to what, you know? So they said, well, we're going to assign you. They didn't want us. They really didn't want us. And they made calls trying to get us back, you know?
Right.
So, okay, we're going to send you down to the 1st 8-inch Howitzer battery, back down at Da Nang, which we just left.
Right.
So they sent us back down there, and we reported back out there. And, you know, we said, well, where are the tanks? Yeah, there are no tanks. But it was, they didn't have track vehicles. It was a self-propelled gun, you know, 8-inch howitzers were. They were on track. You've seen an
M110. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have M110s at that point. They were the previous version, previous generation. M55, maybe? Not sure. But they, I remember they picked me out to go into fire direction for a while because I was smart enough to do it, to learn it. So I worked in the fire direction bunker, you know, where they take the calls from the guys asking for fire missions.
Now, in the FDC, what were you actually doing?
This was before computers, so they had these plotting boards, two of them, and
right.
They had these. Basically, they'd say we're here, grid squares, and all
mm-hmm.
that. You put a pin in it, and get a like a ruler, it's a big metal thing with mm-hmm. range on it, you know, and you'd say, okay, that's azimuth, so and so range, this, and the guy next to you is doing the same thing. So you come up with the same numbers.
Right.
And then they had a slide rule looking thing that helped them calculate elevation.
Mm-hmm.
And they what charge they were going to use, how much powder.
So you were on the plotting table?
Plotting table.
And there was someone else who did that right next to you, was
right,
doing the same
right,
problem?
Radio, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
then over here was a guy on a radio taking the fire mission. And there was usually the watch officer, lieutenant, and we had to do, every fire mission had to be cleared through the Air Force and this is where we're down today, and the Arvin. And that takes time. And sometimes that step was skipped. The mm-hmm. lieutenant, we had a lieutenant who was from all places, Berkeley.
No kidding.
Yeah,
okay.
He was a great guy.
Uh-huh.
And he'd just say, shoot it. The hell we're really? Checking for that.
Really?
Yeah.
What was his name? Do you remember?
Knapp. K-N-A-P-P.
Uh-huh.
Gerald, I think.
Okay. And he was lieutenant?
Yeah.
And his...
First lieutenant. Later a captain, I think, while I was there.
And his background, besides or in addition to being from Berkeley, what do you know anything about
him? No, I don't know
it?
Anything about him except that he was a graduate of UC Berkeley.
Wow.
And he was a character.
Uh-huh.
He was a good guy.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes the guys on the other end of the radio were insistent they needed it right now,
I'm sure.
And sometimes they didn't know where the hell they were, too, which is, how big an 8-inch howitzer round is. It weighs 204 pounds. Because we always knew time of flight from the calculations.
Right.
And we'd always tell them over the radio to splash when it was supposed to hit. And guys would be so far away from where they thought they were, they wouldn't hear it go off.
No kidding. Yeah, that's not the help they needed, but they couldn't give you locations accurately.
Right, they didn't know where they were.
Yeah.
And
Tom, were you in a situation at some point where you had guys in a firefight calling in?
Yeah, that happened.
Yeah.
And we were. I wasn't on the radio, but.
But you were responding in that kind of real time to a crisis, basically.
Right. Right. The only time I ever remember being on a radio is when they called in to register places. Sometimes they'd see a likely spot like a crossroads, or they'd have you shoot out there.
Uh-huh.
And you calculate it, and you write that all down, and it's given a name. And you tell them the name. So if they ever want to fire in that crossroads, they don't have to go through the grid square and observe a target azimuth and all that stuff. They can just tell you, here it is. It's this. Look this up. This is the guy.
What kind of names?
I think they gave numbers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't remember what they...
So you didn't get to be creative with that?
No.
Oh, okay. I just wondered if you got to assign...
No, in fact, you just took the next sequential... Might add a letter in front of it, but you just took the next sequential one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, did you stay with the 12th Marines most of the time?
The first 8-inch howitzer battery?
Yeah.
That's where I ended up.
Okay.
Yeah, I stayed there the whole time.
Okay. You stayed with that unit, but but your placement
relocated. Moved in the spring of 67.
Uh-huh.
We moved up north.
Okay, and by up north you mean what?
To an area... Eventually, right outside of Dong Ha on Highway 9.
Okay.
And we started out at Dong Ha just till we got everybody there and got our act together.
So you were in that location near the river and along Highway 9 for...
Till I left.
The rest of your tour?
Till January of 68, right before the Tet Offensive.
And just to complete this, at that point you moved...
Back into Dong Ha Combat Base.
Okay.
They knew something was up. We'd have been out there by ourselves. It would have been bad.
But that was in, would you say, the middle of January when you moved?
Early January.
Early January.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Dong Ha was the first time I was ever under fire when we first got up to Dong Ha.
Can you tell me about that incident?
Yeah. We were there early. before the rest of them. Some of the guys, some of the drivers, and there was a rocket attack. It was night. And we heard them going over and knew, you know, it's a skill that doesn't require previous training. You know what that is.
Yeah.
And another guy, a guy named Beaver, Marcus Beavers, I think is their Beaver.
Uh-huh.
He was a truck driver. We dove under a truck, and because we hadn't dug holes or anything yet.
You just got there.
And about halfway through this attack, which didn't last too long, I asked Beavers, what's in the truck? And he says, ammo.
Oh, God.
8-inch howitzer ammo.
Oh, geez.
I said, oh, great. I said, well, there won't be anything to bury. We'll save everybody the expense.
At what point did you ask him that? Was it after the shelling?
It was going on still. You know, it was towards the end.
Did that coming under fire for the first time, you know, I don't want to say rattle you, but make you sit up and pay attention more?
Yeah.
Or were you already in that place?
But I read something Churchill said about the exhilaration of being shot at and missed.
Yeah.
The first time, I think that's true, you get a little bit of it. Exhilaration. After you start thinking about it, after that, then you don't want to. You don't want any more of that.
Yeah, that one time's enough.
Yeah.
Now, setting up the fire base that you were constructing, how long did that take, and what was the process?
Well, it seems that there had been somebody there before, because it seems to me that there was a lot of things done.
Okay.
And the land was graded, and it seems to me there was wire.
Okay.
And we added more, and they always add more.
Sure.
They never have enough wire. And remember, we set up the tents, and we dug bunkers. We made bunkers, mostly of our own design. Each section made their own.
Right.
Around our tents. You put up sandbags around your tent above the level of the where you're sleeping.
Yeah.
And then you make a bunker. And we set up a, forget what we called those things where you go to the bathroom.
The privies?
Wooden head,
okay. Mm-hmm.
The four-holer.
Right.
With the diesel fuel gizmos underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And we took turns burning those.
So you got in on all the great duty then.
Oh, yeah. I got to burn those.
As one of the first guys up there. How long did it take to actually put the base in, you know, what you'd call operable condition?
I couldn't tell you. Not very long.
Because
they work you pretty hard.
Yeah.
What else you got to do?
Was this base, I mean, when you first got up there, you had this rocket attack at night. Did you encounter other fire later on, either sporadic or
later?
Another?
Oh, sure. And when we were out on the Highway 9, there was one, the pattern of it was in the summer of 67. I don't think they liked being out in the rain any better than we did, because it seemed to let up during the monsoon.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, it's hard to remember going back through the years, you know, a handful of times, you know, maybe two handfuls, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But they'd fire 5 or 6 rounds. Usually, at that point, it was artillery. And I read in the Marine Corps history that it was 130-millimeter field guns from the DMZ.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 or 6, and it stopped. And I suspect because counterfire would be on them after that. They'd be exposed. And I don't think they had forward observers very often, because they were pretty inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
One Sunday, and I think it was a Sunday, they did that, but they fired about 50 rounds. And they hesitated after every 6 or so.
Is that right?
And we just start to relax, and then 6 more. And I actually saw some of those hit. You know, they were close enough, and they holed our tent with shrapnel, so they were close enough. And there was a new sergeant in the supply section. He just got in there, fresh start, utility. So we dove in this. He had come just when we were building another bunker. So he and I ended up in this new bunker by ourselves. And I can remember, I'm over in the corner, getting small, over in the corner and telling him, oh, they'll stop after 5 or 6. So after about 30, I said, and I'm saying 30 after 36 years or 35 years, I don't remember exactly. It's probably in there somewhere. And I can remember saying, geez, when are they going to stop? I started getting scared, And they finally did stop. But one of the guys in our section had been headed out to, I think this was the same day. This might also not be true. But it did happen. The headed out to it was late in the afternoon, I guess, or dusk. He and another guy headed out to a listening post.
Mm-hmm.
And they were bitching because, maybe this was another day, but they were bitching because we had gotten some beer in and they didn't get their beer.
Mm-hmm.
And our boss, who happened to be officer of the day, told him, all right, you go get one each for you two guys. There's two guys going out there. It's still daylight. What the heck? He went back up and got two Ballantine beers. And when he got back down into our motor pool, one of those artillery rounds hit and blew him into a ditch, into a trench. None of the shrapnel hit him. He got cut a little from hitting the ground, basically. I walked down the next day, and there was a 5-ton truck down there on the other side of the blast with holes in the tailgate, like 3 or 4 inches across, all flat tires. And he doesn't get a scratch, and he says he did not drop the beer. I still see him. He's over in Indianapolis. He claims he did not drop the beer.
The concussion, though, blew him off his feet.
Yeah, into a... He said it felt like somebody hit him in the chest with a sledgehammer. And he said that... after a while, he said he must have put the beer down because it hurt so bad. He said his chest hurt so bad that he took out his... He had a K-bar knife.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted the pain to be somewhere else. And he started cutting on his arm. Because he wasn't thinking. His brain was completely...
Wow.
Completely scrambled. He said, I started cutting my arm. And but he was okay. Turned out fine. They sent him over to the main base to get x-rayed or something.
Uh-huh. And to chill out, did he have a chance... to have some downtime there, or did he come right back? Do you know?
He came right back to work.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
His dad was a... I told Richard this story. This guy over in Indianapolis, the same guy,
yeah,
was a diver in high school. And actually won the Junior Olympics twice. And he used to tell us, all those guys that Greg Louganis beat? He says, I beat them too.
No kidding.
And he was supposed to go. His dad was a retired colonel, Marine Corps. His brothers, he had twin brothers that ended up both being colonels in the Air Force.
Wow.
He got mad at his dad. He didn't want to dive anymore. He had a scholarship to get to Indiana. Uh-huh. They were talking about it.
Yeah.
And didn't want to do it anymore. He said he had no social life. He had nothing. It was dive, mm-hmm. school. That's it. Mm-hmm. And he got in a big fight, and he joined the Marine Corps.
And did he stay in, do you know? Did
no.
he only he served his...
Served 4 years.
Okay.
And he is a Marion County, Indiana deputy sheriff. He was a good guy. And, of course, he's got a, his dad was a colonel, his two brothers are colonels, he was a sergeant.
Well, it would be great if we could interview him, too, and include him in this project.
Skyler Atkins is his name.
Okay.
And he, he's double-dipping, I think. He retired once from the sheriff's department. He's back.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, ironically, he says, you know what I'm doing now? I'm working in supply. That's what I was doing with you guys.
It sounds like that's a good place for him. I mean, after all, he didn't drop the beer. You know, he's a safe pair of hands. I think it's a it's probably a good place for him.
He's a funny one. He still runs every day, 4 or 5 miles, but he smokes like a chimney.
No kidding.
I don't know.
Huh.
And he's been married a long time. He's got a couple sons. Yeah, a lot of, most of our guys turned out pretty good. We got one that came to the last reunion who's a recovering alcoholic. And, another one recovered from, as a drug addict, recovered.
Uh-huh. Have either of those guys said anything to you that those problems were related to Vietnam experience?
Or they've never said that to me, and I don't know.
Okay.
I know that when they came back, they didn't do well, that's all.
Yeah.
Whether that's the cause or whether...
Yeah, who knows, right?
They had just got started earlier if they hadn't gotten hit.
Right.
Who knows?
Right. Tom, let's take a break for a minute. Tom, let's continue. I wanted to ask about your time, particularly at Dong Hoa. What were your living conditions like? Where did you sleep?
Once we got set up, we had GP medium tents. There were... I think there were maybe 6, 8 of us in there with cots, which we figured out how to get a poncho liner or to make them a little softer, and we could get blankets, and that's what we slept on. We would get pallets, wooden pallets from shipping, and put a floor in. Otherwise, the rats drive you crazy. Because they find you, no matter where you are. Rats.
Yeah, did you see rats? Did they get close to you?
No. Well, we used to trap them sometimes.
How'd you do that?
We had these cages that you could bait.
Okay.
Oh, this sounds terrible.
That's okay.
This goes to show you what amusement among guys over there amounts to.
Uh-huh.
But we would then we did this for a little while. Then electrocute the rats with radio batteries, sticking wires in, let them bite.
Yeah.
That was it. Zap. And the rats went away.
How long did they last after they'd bitten on the wire?
Sometimes they'd just be stunned and sometimes not.
Just
But we hooked a few up in series, I guess. We didn't do that for very long because you had to use radio batteries. And they didn't like that.
They being the...
Calm guys.
Uh-huh.
We did that for a while. But mostly you'd hear them scurrying around underneath those pallets.
Yeah.
They didn't come up usually. And we lost interest in the rats after a while.
Right. Were there other animals or insects that impinged on your privacy or your
centipede or those big ugly centipedes they had over there?
Yeah, like what, 3 or 4 inches long?
Yeah, like that.
Yep.
This thick with the. They occasionally...
Were they biting or stinging, those guys?
I was never bitten or stung by it. They say that they can hurt you, but I don't know, to tell you the truth.
Uh-huh.
And I think they had scorpions over there, too, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
And we did arrange a match between a centipede and a scorpion, I think.
Uh-huh.
In a shoebox.
That's nasty. Well... Who won?
Scorpion.
Yeah, I thought maybe.
Yay.
What else did you guys do for amusement when things got boring, when the rats were no longer interesting and, you know, you conquered the scorpion thing?
Yeah, I don't know. We read. I read a lot. One of the guys in the tent used to get recordings from his wife, and we listened to those. She probably doesn't know that.
Were they general interest recordings? Like, this is what we're doing today, and last week I had over
mostly,
the in-laws?
Yeah,
or something more
private.
Flavorful?
Sometimes they were more private,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
we were desperate for something to do.
So what were you reading? How did you get books? Go ahead.
I don't know how I got books. People sent them to me, or they got passed around.
Sure.
We also would get packages from home with food. I used to get, my mother used to send me the Chef Boyardee cans of ravioli and spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
I've never eaten one since. I used to eat them cold.
Yeah.
I can't eat them now. They're awful. And we used to get those. We used to get those things with the summer sausage and the cheese and those boxes, you know.
Yep.
And we'd share those. And when and sometimes somebody would send us some alcohol.
And it could get through?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
I don't know how many were intercepted. I sent them some after I got home. Sent them back some.
Uh-huh.
We'd do that. We'd talk, tell stories about home.
Mm-hmm.
Bitch about the lifers. That's common.
Right.
And it wasn't popular in our group, but I know there was some marijuana smoke down the row of tents. Because I hear people giggling in there. But
could you smell it too?
Yeah, sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But was it a problem, or was it just a recreational thing that guys were doing?
It was just recreational. I was always scared to get involved in it, because that was still a felony then.
Mm-hmm.
It was also, you know, and I wanted to get out. And if you spent time in a brig, that was bad time. You had to make that up.
That's right. Was that really present in your mind in terms of governing your own behavior?
And I see. No way. I don't want to miss by one day. I went out of this place.
And were you one of the guys that was keeping track of your days?
Oh, yeah. They're marked. Every day's marked on the pages.
Okay. And that's a reference to the diary that you're depositing with us, which will be available in the Vietnam archive. Were the other guys in the unit, would you say, or in the tent, friends? Did you guys kind of gel as a group? Or
I'd say we were friends. There was a couple guys who were closer than the rest, you know, that they were buddies. Because some of them were there before I got there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then new guys would come after we had already been there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys I was friends with, he came later, is a psychologist in the vet center in Pittsburgh.
Is that right?
Yeah. He can't afford to come out. He's got two kids in college.
Come out to the reunion that you're attending.
Yeah, uh-huh. Right.
Did that one-year rotation policy where guys were coming in and leaving at different times kind of interrupt the stability?
Our rotation was 13 months.
Yes, that's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're right.
And I was actually 13 months shore to shore. So really, I was about 12 and 20.
Mm-hmm.
So they started, while I was there, they started cutting it back to 12 gradually.
Mm-hmm.
The Marines did. And I think eventually they were 12 just like the Army. I never gave much thought to what that did to the whole picture. It was staggered enough so that things went on, you know.
Yeah.
Life went on.
Let me ask a little bit about the managing the environment, if you want. We were talking when we were upstairs about the monsoon season and how difficult that was. How did you said that you guys after a while just stopped trying to stay dry?
Right. Even inside the tent leaked.
I think that's endemic.
You know, we'd have to move it wouldn't drip on us while we were sleeping. You know. And a lot of boards were laid down outside on the paths that you would like to go.
I'm clear, yes.
And we could, you know, stay out of the mud to some extent that way. But it got muddy and ugly, you know, it was, and wet. And we just wouldn't change clothes for days.
And did you get sick, Tom? Did guys get sick? I mean, respiratory things or problems with your feet or that kind of stuff? From being wet?
I don't ever remember being sick over there. Yes, I do. The first couple days I was there, the water. You know,
yeah.
Get the, what they call here, the monsoon is revenge.
Yeah.
But anyway, my buddy over in Indianapolis still has a toenail fungus he picked up over there. He's never gotten rid of it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just...
And he got... And some guys got what they call fear driving. They would get something called jeep seat. You get a red rear end, you know.
It was called jeep seat?
Yeah. It was from sitting and sweating and, you know.
Oh, God.
And... but the wet didn't seem to make people sicker than normal.
Okay.
Maybe that was that they were still giving us those gamma goblin shots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We call those the Halloween shots, gamma goblin. And they stopped giving us those eventually, because they used to give them to us when they gave us our pay or whatever pay we got.
So they give you the pay and also give you a shot?
Yeah, paid in the Corman's tent, right.
That's
so they got everybody.
And they made sure this was one party you had to come to, right, to get your pay.
And they stopped doing that in 67. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. Maybe they found out it was useless.
Mm-hmm.
And those were a painful shot, though, because they did them by weight, I think. If you were bigger, you got more.
Right.
They hurt. But I don't remember being... they vaccinated us against everything. Bubonic plague, diphtheria, you know.
Had that all happened before you went out to Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I got those in the States.
Mm-hmm. Any follow-up shots on those varieties once you were in country? Boosters?
Well,
or
the pay thing?
Yeah.
They checked your shot card when you went in there.
Oh, okay, so if you were due up, they would...
You got your gamma goblin and you got your other stuff, too.
Now, was it the medics who were doing this?
Yeah, the corpsmen.
The corpsmen, uh-huh.
Yeah.
And,
that's just garbage.
Was there a doctor that was assigned to who would visit the FBC at all?
No.
Did you ever see a doctor?
While I was in Vietnam?
Yeah.
No.
Never?
No.
And what about a dentist?
No.
Huh. You know, you told me about one incident. It was during the monsoon season where you had to go out and we're supposed to be observing traffic on the river. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, that was up in the guard, we call the guard tower. It was, had them all around Dong Ha so you could spot something, you could triangulate.
Mm-hmm.
Hit it. You had a battery, you had a BC scope and a radio and a 50 caliber machine gun up there.
And you were by yourself?
Yeah, you're by yourself.
Uh-huh.
At night. And guy over at the 12th Marines wanted me to count the boats coming down that river across the road from us at night. And it's pouring down rain. I couldn't see anything. And I, you know, I'm underneath a poncho trying to just not be driven nuts by this pouring down rain because it's coming sideways. The roof on this thing doesn't help. It's not that big around, you know. It's coming in the
right
spots.
Oh, sure.
There's no way you can escape.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, it was just a fool's errand. There wasn't anything.
It was hopeless.
Yeah.
Was there typically a lot of traffic on the river? I mean,
I never saw
local
that
traffic.
Much.
Uh-huh.
During the day, you might see a boat or two, but I always supposed that somebody somewhere was checking us out, you know, before they...
Oh, mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Maybe they weren't. But it wasn't that big a river. You know, there wasn't much you could take down that river.
Right.
That little stream.
About how far across was it where you were? Any estimate?
I couldn't tell you. hit, you know, 20 or 30 yards, maybe.
Really?
You know,
uh-huh.
But not really big. And it was on the other side of the Highway 9 from us.
Right. And you mentioned that there were other bases there. The Army had a base.
Yeah, right next to us was an Army artillery battery, and I think it was 105s. And then to the right was, I think, Mike Battery, 12th Marines. I think they were 105s. And we shared the same compound. There was wire separating us because they came at different times. But we were all hooked together there. Mm-hmm. The road went through. A road went through the whole thing.
Now, for somebody who wasn't clear, how's a mic battery different from what you were affiliated with?
Well, I think they were 105s. And they're more of a company, like a company in the infantry, an artillery battery in the Marine Corps is. But the 8-inch Hauser batteries were different. They were a little bigger, mm-hmm. manpower-wise. They had a battalion-level supply, and they were part of force troops, with force recon and the tank battalions. But we were attached operationally to the 12th Marines.
Okay.
And that happened before I got there, because the first 8-inch Hauser battery would have been attached to the 11th Marines, I think, and the 3rd to the 12th. You know, we changed divisions.
Sure.
Because
mm-hmm.
something got, ended up the 3rd Marine Division, because something got, you know, positionally it was just made more sense. You know,
uh-huh.
It was one of those things.
Administratively, or in terms of supply, did it make any difference?
And we went to 12th Marines for our supply.
Okay.
We stocked parts because we were battalion level supply.
Okay.
But anything we didn't have, we went up a notch to 12th Marines to get.
Now, by stocking parts, how broadly should one understand that? In other words, you have them on hand, or could?
Yeah, we had some of the more commonly used items for the M110 8-inch howitzers.
Right.
We would have stocked. And to give you an idea about how much, I think maybe it was a GP medium tent and a half, maybe, of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And 12th Marines was only up at Dong Ha, so, you know, we could get stuff. We never had it. We didn't have everything we were supposed to have, because I can remember we were going to have an inspection, and the lieutenant in charge of supply had me typing up requisitions. Because everything you didn't have, you had to have a requisition on file.
Okay. To show that you were actively getting it.
Yeah, I was uh-huh. trying to get this, and they haven't sent it.
Okay.
And we, and every month they did something, I think it was every month, they did a logistical summary that we had to type up and send over for somebody to look at. So what we had, what we didn't have. And I did those sometimes. The lieutenant would say, you know, powers do this, and this is last month's, just, you know, get mm-hmm. the figures, stick it in here. This buddy of mine from New Jersey used to call those the logisms. It was log sum is what it was supposed to be. Called the logisms. Jeez.
And why was powers chosen for this vaulted duty?
I think you could trust powers to do it right.
Oh, okay. And you know, this is interesting because you're trained in tank.
Yeah.
You know, actually worked in FDC and artillery.
Yeah.
And then you got called on to do supply stuff. And
I did the message center too in between.
Okay.
For a month or.
How'd that work?
Oh God, that was awful. We had. You know what a Condex box is?
No.
Those big metal shipping containers.
Oh, okay.
They cut a door in one, made a door, and they put the message center inside this thing. So we'd get these messages, and every one of them had to be logged. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
I had this book.
Right.
And I'd be sitting in this thing in the summer in Dong Ha. I got my shirt off. This is no kidding. I'm logging these things in with a pen. And my sweat is blurring the ink. It's hitting the pages.
Actually, yeah. I completely believe that. What would the temperature have been in there, 115?
I don't know. I didn't have a thermometer. It's probably good. I didn't know. And I have to log all that stuff in. And then eventually, I think I got in a row with the first sergeant about something. And I was fired. Sent over to supply. Another, you know, but that was, God, that was hot.
And you did this for about a month?
Yeah, it seems. There was another guy who did it that was in charge, a guy, a sergeant named Risden. But I got...
You got canned?
I just got to work. I was glad to get out of there. That was just really... I did know when we moved before everybody else did. Because I had to get clearance to do that.
How did that clearance thing work?
It turned out that to be in tanks, you had to have a secret clearance.
Okay.
Except that they hadn't activated it. And what had to happen was the FBI had to talk to my neighbors.
Back in the state.
Yeah, it happened overnight, practically.
Did anybody ever tell you later on that they'd been asked about
the FBI? I could have just said they did, you know.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Now, by activating the clearance. What was that? Just flipping some kind of administrative switch?
It was administrative. You know, basically he said, okay, he's clear to look at these messages. But there are other messages I couldn't look at.
And who was handling those?
Probably the officers.
Oh, okay. That brings up a question that's sometimes very interesting. What in your experience was the relationship between officers and enlisted men? I mean, was it, would you say, a healthy relationship, or was there hostility, or did it vary by person?
It varied, and we had my boss, Lieutenant Mitchin, was an excellent guy, and I've seen him. He came to one of our reunions with his wife.
How do you spell his last name?
Metschan.
Okay.
He's out in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And he's a banker of some kind. He'd probably be mad if I just said he was a banker. He's got some highly exalted international status of some kind.
Okay, well, if he'd like to, he can fill us in on that.
And he stayed in the reserves and retired as a colonel.
Okay.
And his name is strange enough that he was easy to find when
yes.
I was organizing reunions. There is another John Mitchin now, his son. But
you mean using the internet you could locate
him?
Yeah,
that's how I organized the first couple reunions. I probably found 100 guys over 4 or 5 years. Since the website, we get more.
Were you working from your memory of their names, or did you have a unit roster or your own records?
I had these, and I had my memory.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, we did get a couple. We found out how to write to Marine Corps and get unit rosters from a couple months.
Yes, yes.
And I got names off of there.
Mm-hmm.
And... there are people there's always some people you want to find that you just can't find. There was a cook we had, a Puerto Rican guy named Roberto Rosada Cuascut. I remembered his name because it was... And I played chess with him sometimes, and he was a great guy. He was from the Bronx, New York, and we can't find him. We don't know where he is.
What was he like? He said he was a great guy. Nice guy.
Very smart and thoughtful type of person.
Mm-hmm.
And he cared about the food. You know, he actually made his own sauce when we got steaks. Sometimes we'd have steaks, he made his own recipe sauce on them. You know, he made an effort to make the food taste good, which was a great thing.
So you had a mess that was actually on the base, on the fire base?
Yeah. We had in a tent, right?
Uh-huh. And how many people was he cooking for? A
couple hundred. Well, I don't know how they handled the outlying guys.
Right.
Whether he cooked hot food there and they took it out.
Uh-huh.
There was 220 people in the battery, I think.
Yeah, that's a pretty tall order.
But there was a couple guys. I mean, it wasn't just him alone. He wasn't in charge. There was actually a staff sergeant in charge.
And do you know how to spell his last name?
Yeah.
How is that?
Rosado, R-O-S-A-D-O,
uh-huh.
Quascut, C-U-A-S-C-U-T. The Marine Corps had him listed with no dash in between, but I know Crosscoat was his mother's name.
Uh-huh. Just can't locate him or... We'll take a break. We'll take a break for a second. Tom, are there other guys that you remember that you haven't been able to contact?
There was a guy in our section named John Mitchell, who's from Wichita. And we actually found him once, and he got divorced and moved, and, you know, there's nobody at that number or address anymore, and he's lost.
And that name is too common.
Yeah, there's a gazillion of them.
Yeah.
And he was a printer. I know that. Huh. He was probably in a printer's union someplace. And he was part Native American. We had several. In fact, the recently retired chairman of the Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Indian Nation was in our unit.
What's his name?
Anthony, he likes to be called.
Uh-huh.
Anthony Washines. W-A-S-H-I-N-E-S.
What was his job?
I think he was on the guns. And I don't really remember him specifically. You know, because we were spread out. There was 220. But I know he was there. And his cousin was there, too. A guy named Cyrus Dick.
Uh-huh.
Who was also Yakima. We had a Lakota Sioux corpsman. Whose name was Lenny? Let's see, Louis Whirlwind Soldier.
Whirlwind Soldier.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's a good Lakota name.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
What was he like?
I don't remember him too much. I remember the name, you know. I
mean, yes.
You just don't run across it, but we found him. And the funny thing about Anthony or Tony, as
sure,
uh-huh, he was known then. Is my brother and his wife actually went out to that reservation to do church work on the reservation. And I said, stop in and see. He stopped in and saw.
He saw him?
Yep. And he said he remembered my name, but he couldn't place my face, you know.
Have you seen him at one of the reunions? Or
no, I'm kind of hoping he makes it down to this one.
Wow. There were other Native Americans that you remember?
Those three are the three I remember. Ann Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember anymore.
What about African Americans? Were there?
Yeah, we had a great guy in our section named Riggins. Leon Riggins. He was from Pittsburgh. The whole time he was over there with us, he was talking about how he was going to buy himself a Mustang when he got home. And he got home, got transferred to Camp Lejeune, and was trying to go home from Pittsburgh to Pittsburgh on a weekend and fell asleep at the wheel. Killed himself.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
He would have been something, too. He was a good kid. And back then, his dad was a printer in the Pittsburgh Press, or, you know, those jobs, this has all changed now.
That's right.
But they were inherited.
Right, there was this was like a guild almost where
yeah.
they passed on the
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he would have gotten that job if he'd wanted it. He was a really smart, bright kid. And my friend in Pittsburgh, who's the psychologist,
right.
was having a meeting with some vets one day, and he knew Leon.
Is that right?
And one of the guys told him that he was dead. And we didn't know. And he said, I had to stop the meeting. He said, I just couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
13 months in Vietnam and then run your car off the road. You know. He visited his grave up in Pittsburgh.
Did
if
he?
I ever get up to see him, see him, I will too. And we had a sergeant that came. That sergeant that was in the bunker with me.
Mm-hmm. In the Press New Utilities.
Yeah, that yeah. was the that he was an African American. His name was Frazier. And they eventually started calling him Smiley. Smiley mm-hmm. Frazier. He was a good guy, but I didn't get to know him real well because I left soon after that.
While you were there, did you see any tensions between African Americans and whites, or Hispanics and blacks, or any of that?
On an individual basis, there was one black guy who was really pretty hateful. I don't know if he had a bad time or what, but he was nasty. But you got to remember, this was before Martin Luther King was assassinated, mm-hmm. which was in April 68.
That's right.
My friend in Pittsburgh, whose tour spanned that, said that things were different after that. Even with Riggins, he said there was a little bit of a distance after
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But race relations were not a problem in our unit in 90%. And in the Marine Corps, in boot camp, I can remember if the Hispanic guys, we'd go into a classroom or a situation where we're going to sit down and listen to somebody.
Sure.
Our drill instructor would look, and if there were groups, he'd separate them.
Really?
Yeah, he'd say, we're all green. I don't want any of you guys bunching up like that. He said, and he'd
move
us
green.
All around. Right?
I like that. Wow.
I think he's dead now. I was trying to find him on the internet. That was the head drill instructor. And I think we lost a drill instructor in Vietnam, although his name was Johnson. So,
do you know when it might have been that he... You're talking 60, about KIA?
Yeah, uh-huh. 60... Well, I got out of boot camp in 66. And so it would have been 7, 8, or 9, 67 or 8.
Right.
His name was R.L. Johnson. Little black man.
Mm-hmm.
Tough. I think we lost him. We lost 6 or 7 guys out of my platoon in boot camp. This is a pretty heavy casualty rate for 80 guys.
Absolutely. And did you know much of this, like, contemporarily?
I knew one. I saw his name in the Stars and Stripes. You know, when they had a cat killed in action thing. It was a really... I was the second oldest guy in the platoon in boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was the oldest guy. He was 24, I think.
What was his name?
Wysinski. And he was an infantry guy who was killed, I heard, in an ambush. That's all I know.
You don't know where it might have been?
No. He was from Milwaukee, I think. And I met his fiancée after boot camp when they came down to see us graduate,
Yeah, right.
And he married her and then went off and was killed that following January. So they couldn't have been married in 6 months.
And not together for most of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Tom, were there casualties on the fire race while you were there? From mortars or...
Just in our unit, most of the casualties were at Camlo or GLN. There was a bunch at GLN, and one of the KIAs we had was at GLN. A guy who was on his second extension. And Quezon, there were some casualties. Where we were, there was only the guy from Indianapolis, the two beers guy. While I was there,
mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate not to have to see those things happen.
Yeah.
And I had met the one guy who was killed. When I first came to the unit in Da Nang, he was there in that tent where I was getting ready to go on his first extension leave. They gave you 30 days. Then he came back and did 6 more months. And I met him. And I think he was killed in July. Right after. I think he got back from another extension leave. I can't remember how exactly it worked out.
Mm-hmm. But you had met him.
I had met him, yeah. And he was killed. And he didn't die right there. It was a couple days later. I can remember the chaplain came, and we had a memorial service on a little hill right in front of the supply tent. There was a row of tents like this, and it went down into a flat spot. Right here in this hill, we sat there. And had a memorial service. He was 20, I think.
Yeah, all of 20. These are very, very young men. Given that you were a little bit older than some of them, did they take the mickey out of you sometimes? Did they call you an old man or anything like that?
Not too much. I was in the States. I was very useful because I could buy liquor.
That's true. You were everybody's friend.
I was everybody's friend, and I could rent the car.
Oh, okay, right. Also true.
So in California, when we were out there and got our first leave, I remember we rented a wreck from some place, and I had to drive, and we went to Disneyland, of all places. Then we stayed in the hotel, and I went out to this carryout. I remember having my T-shirt on, and my dog tags were hanging down, you know. I walked in, and the place was run by this old master chief from the Navy.
Really?
And I asked him if he wanted to see ID, and he said, "You don't need any." Gave me the stuff, and away we went. As it so happens, I was legal, but he didn't care.
What other things did you see that would tell us or tell future listeners something about the relationship between the Navy and the Marines?
The Navy corpsmen they were well respected. I mean, because the Marines doesn't have their own medical personnel.
Right.
He is the Navy. And the one corpsman that comes to our reunion, Tim McCormick, just razzes all of us two-year guys because he says that he was in the Marines longer than we were. And he was a he's a good guy, but I actually didn't know him over there. He was behind me here. I might have told you I met him organizing reunions when I met him.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And he came through. He was a registered nurse in New Jersey and later on in California without ever going to nursing school.
How did that work?
He had to sue to take the boards.
He had to sue because on the basis of his
because
having
he,
this experience? He had a bunch of experience.
He had all this experience in combat medicine.
Right.
And he wanted to be a nurse. And they said, "Well, fine, go to nursing school.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "And teach or what?"
Right, right. And he compelled them? He compelled the boards?
Took them to court. Yeah.
And was found favorable to him?
Favorably, and he took the boards and passed. And he did the same thing.
Wow.
He worked in emergency rooms.
Yeah.
And he did the same thing in California when he moved out there.
Yeah.
But then he doesn't know where he got it, but he picked up hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a...
Yep. So then he started... he's in the union business. He was organizing, when I first met him, interns in California, the doctors. He organized medical people.
Right.
And now he's doing something. He's in the unions still, but I don't know exactly what he's doing.
But he's still out in California?
Yeah.
I mean, that's his base.
He's got a wife and a couple kids out there.
Tom, you had to move from Dong Ha in January of 68, and we talked about that being before Tet.
Yeah.
But based on what you think was probably some intel about...
Yeah, I would guess. I mean, I don't believe in those big coincidences like that.
Was there scuttlebutt at the time to why you were moving? Or?
No. Nope. We moved back in Dong Ha. And I think we probably asked the supply officer why we were moving, and he didn't tell us, or if he knew. I mean, because nobody likes to move. Moving...
Yeah.
The M word, you know.
Yeah.
It's bad. It's bad civilian life.
I agree with you on that. I've done it enough. That move was back down to Da Nang then?
No. Back into the Dong Ha combat base.
Into the combat base. Okay.
Yeah.
And
where the 12th Marines were, we actually shared, the supply guys shared a big metal building on one end. We and the other end was the 12th Marine supply.
How long did it take to actually accomplish the move? Was it something that was done like pronto?
Or a few days, you know.
Is that right?
Yeah. A lot of stuff gets thrown away when you move. If you've got, you collect stuff like maybe a little thing with a, like a vanity or something to put your shaving stuff on. A little mirror in the garbage.
Uh-huh.
Oversized footlocker in the garbage.
Really?
You know.
And so do you just leave a pile of
set
garbage?
On fire. Yeah.
Oh, you burned it. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then we went up and we actually lived pretty high that last 3 or 4 weeks because we had the metal roof CB built buildings mm-hmm. up off the ground, you mm-hmm. know, with the stairs going up.
Like real houses almost.
Well.
Getting close to it.
Yeah.
After the tent thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The roof didn't leak.
Right. And how many guys in a room there?
I think we was 8 there.
Okay. And
there's another funny story in that
one,
too.
Yeah.
The same guy in Indianapolis, he's sleeping in a sleeping bag, you know. And you're supposed to be able to get out of those really easy, you know.
Yeah.
And this actually happened after I left because it was McPeak, the guy in Pittsburgh, who actually did this. Because Atkins was, they get some incoming and they go to run to their bunker, which is next to their house. And he can't get out of his sleeping bag. And you can rip out of them if you can. They make them that way. But he was struggling with it. McPeak grabbed his feet.
Yeah.
And just pulled him down the aisle and down the steps. He said, bump, bump, bump. and then dragged him into the bunker. That was funny.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Now, were you still doing fire control type stuff at this point? When you moved?
No, I was away from fire control rather early.
Okay, so now...
Most of my tour was supply, right?
And so you're working as a basically what I guess the Navy calls a pork chop, right? I mean,
a clerk.
Okay, and you're doing the supply work.
Yeah, we're keeping get close to the mechanics and the guys that take care of stuff. They come in and say, "Hey, I need this." Yeah. We look it up in these manuals. Say, "Okay, that's an SO or a blah blah blah." They went on punch cards. Those same punch cards.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, when they came back, I guess they had those punch cards with them. We didn't have punch cards. We'd write them up. But I was one of the few people who could read a punch card by looking at the holes.
Right, right. So somebody...
That came useful one time or another when they weren't interpreted, you know. But I'd order stuff. It would come, and I'd call on the field phones out to the guns and say, "Hey, you're the mechanics," and say, "You're so and so's here," you know.
So you would fill out a requisition form,
right.
And then somebody else somewhere would do data entry and punch it to the cards.
Yeah, in Okinawa.
Okay. Oh, okay, that was happening in Japan.
Could be. I don't think it was at 12th Marines. It went to 12th Marines, and then what happened after that, I'm not sure, but it ended up in Okinawa. That's where the big stuff was.
Right.
Less the 12th Marines had.
Were there any problems getting hold of specific things that you remember that there were these shortages or it just wasn't in the pipeline?
No, I don't remember us being short stuff that was really critical. I don't remember us being short.
Okay. At the end of January, you yourself were very short.
Yeah.
And no doubt...
Dangle my feet off a dime.
Yeah. Is that what they said?
Yeah.
Okay. But this is the point at which Tet...
January 31st,
began.
I think.
Yeah. Do you have recollections of that night or the nights thereafter being particularly eventful?
Not too much. I mean, I remember hearing that Highway 1 was cut going out to GLN and that they took 8-inch howitzer ammo out to our guns by helicopter. Those big nets full of them.
Yeah.
And I know the gun guys said that they fired nonstop for All day long, all night long, they fired.
Yeah. I heard they fired so long in some locations that the barrels got hot. And they had to back it down or throw water on it or something.
It's not, yeah. That's a, yeah. That, 8-inch howitzers, one of the gun guys was telling me that the book says you can put a round out every minute if you do it according to oil.
Right.
You know, if you use the hydraulic lift to pick it up and put it in there and do all the stuff. And
yeah, but...
He said they could get one out every 19 seconds, which was...
No kidding.
Hand doing whatever they needed to do.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And that's putting that 204-pound projectile in there and ramming it and putting powder bags behind it, putting the gizmo, whatever they call that, in the breech to ignite the whole thing, slamming it shut, shooting. That guy who told me that lost a tip of a finger in a breech.
Yeah.
I can tell you exactly how much that's worth, but I forget what he told me.
Oh, okay. He got a dollar figure, did he, at some point?
Yeah, there's a dollar figure a month that he gets a check.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and take a break for today, Tom.
All right.
This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Tom Powers of the U.S. Marine Corps. Today's date is the 4th of October, 2004. I am in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and I'm speaking with Tom by telephone. Tom, you're in Butler County, Ohio. Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to continue the interview with you today. And I want to just pick up where we left off the last time we spoke, which involved your discussion of, I believe, January 1968, when you were moving again, this time, I think, to Dong Ha. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you tell a little bit about the circumstances of the move?
I don't remember a lot about it. We were in, since the reunion, I know, my reunion in June, I know that the place where we were on Highway 9 was called Dong Ha West.
Okay.
Which I didn't know before.
Uh-huh.
After it took 30-some years for me to find that out. But we packed up and moved over to Dong Ha. And at that point, nobody, at least nobody was telling us that they were expecting an offensive.
Nobody was giving that information to you?
No.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But looking back on it, I expect that we were sort of hanging out there alone, almost, and the best place for us was inside if there was going to be trouble. So we set up with the 12th Marines in Dong Ha, and we lived better there than we had lived so far because we actually got in those, we call them the tin roof hooches. They were the things the Seabees built with the screen sides and the tin roof and stairs going up the front, you know. And 8 of us, I think, were in one of those. And that was as good as we had lived from a physical standpoint. It had always been tents or less before, and we built a bunker right next to it, so we had a place to go in case of incoming artillery or rockets and stuff like that. And we had a good-sized mess hall that must have fed quite a few people that we went to. Another tin roof operation. Which I understand after I left that the tin roof made quite a reflection in the sun, and one day they used it for a target.
They being who?
The North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong. It was hit with an artillery round or two. But anyway, we shared a big building in the supply section with the 12th Marines Supply, which was a bigger operation, 12th Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And we set up in that building, and when I say building, it was one of those metal things that they throw up, you know, overnight, I guess. I don't know what they call them.
Mm-hmm, some kind of a prefab structure, though.
Yeah, And we stayed in there pretty much until I left. Tet offensive, I think, started at the end of January, didn't it? January 31st.
I believe that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we right where we were, did not notice too much. We knew that the platoons, the gun platoons in our battery, which were stretched out in other places, were cut off. Highway 1 was cut. And all the 8-inch howitzer ammo for our unit, say it, our platoon, gun platoons at GLN was going up mm-hmm. by helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from talking to the guys at the reunion that they fired nonstop, virtually. And, till the gun tubes were too hot, you know, they had to rest them a little while.
These were your artillery guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, because we had some at GON, and I don't know if we were at Quezon yet. That happened right as I left. We had a platoon. We had two guns out there. There were two in a platoon. 2 8-inch howitzers.
Mm-hmm.
But for us right there, it didn't seem like there was any big attack on the Zhonghua combat base. I mean, just the occasional rocket or artillery, but that was a pretty big place. There was a small airfield there for C-130s and cargo planes to come in. So it was a fairly good size place. And early in February, of course, I finally got my orders to go home, which was, I don't have my diary anymore. You have that.
Right.
So, but it was early February.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
And I got orders, what they call separation orders, which meant when I went home, I had less than 60 days to do anyway, so they were going to let me out. I remember getting my orders and shaking hands with Jim Egloff, who was acting CO then. He was a captain. I saw him again at a reunion a couple years ago, and he's in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then, back then, I didn't know his name. His first name was Captain back then.
Right, right.
But anyway, he said, good job, and we'll see you. And I went up to took a truck, or they loaded a bunch of us on a truck and drove us up to the airfield. This was, you know, somewhere around the 7th or 8th or 10th or somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. And we finally got a flight out on a C-123, which is older than the C-130s. They're a two-engine propeller-driven thing, and they had some little jets on the end of the wings to help them take off real short, you know, from the short fields.
Was that was an adaptation?
Yeah.
For the theater. That wasn't standard on the 123, was it, or do you know?
I'm not sure. Well, it wasn't when it was first built, that's
sure,
for sure.
Sure, yeah.
But, we flew from Donghua down to Da Nang.
Uh-huh.
And then we had to go register at the transient area, they called it, where they put you up overnight while your plane waited, while you waited for your flight. And I remember there was another fellow that was going home with me, that a Puerto Rican fellow from New York,
mm-hmm.
named Roberto Rosada Quascut. I remember his name because he was a cook, and he was a great cook. He used to have his own little recipes that he really tried to make the food taste good.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a smart guy. We actually used to play chess now and then, but we lined up to get a blanket because it was a little chilly still, I mean, relatively speaking. And they made you sign for these blankets. And we were in this line, and they came and got names off this roster of people who were getting blankets and drafted them for interior guard because the Tet Offensive was going off. So these are guys going home. And they issued them rifles. So we're still in line. So we talked it over and decided we didn't need a blanket. And that we would find some other way.
Mm-hmm.
So
can I just ask, Tom, how did you figure out that they were linking?
Well, we saw them come up and get names off of it while
while
we were in line.
Okay. Okay, so you skedaddled out of line there?
Yeah, we got out of line. And we went, and we ended up spending the night on the in the sand by the runway at Da Nang. And that's about as far inside Da Nang mm-hmm. as you could get.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there were fighter bombers going, taking off all night. And every time one of them roared by, you'd sit up, you know. We managed to get some sleep. And the next day, they put us in a truck and carted us to the other side, I think, of the airport. And we waited there. And then a Continental Airlines DC-8 landed. And taxied over to where we were. And 160 new guys got off. And they unloaded their sea bags. And 160 guys that were rotating out got on with their... They put their sea bags in the baggage compartment.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we razzed the new guys when they came by.
Now, you mentioned that, I think, the last time that we talked, that you gave hard time to the newbies. Can you describe and tell us what exactly the exchanges were, or was it all one-sided? And
oh, they didn't say anything. We mostly said stuff like, because this was February, we would wish them Happy Thanksgiving, which meant, you know, you're going to be here next Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to be gone, and Merry Christmas, and you'll be sorry, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
Anything even crueler than that, now that you think back?
No.
Okay.
Not when I was there, not that I heard.
Okay.
But there wasn't any good advice either.
Yeah, that was still pretty hard.
Like, keep your head down, you know. Then, okay, so we got on the plane, and we were amazed to find out there were stewardesses on this plane,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty amazing and pretty brave of the stewardesses, too, right in the middle of the Tet Offensive. And the plane, without refueling, taxied out and took off. I've heard lots of people say everybody cheered when the plane took off and that kind of stuff. Nobody did anything on our plane. It was quiet, dead quiet. And I don't know if that was because we were worried about, you know, getting high enough in the air soon so we could know we were safe,
mm-hmm.
or what, but there was nothing.
How did you actually feel, Tom? Can you remember how you felt?
I can remember thinking that I wanted to get higher. You know, I figured somebody could be standing around, you know, with a... It wouldn't take much, you know, if you hit an engine or something, a machine gun or, you know, some kind of... I didn't expect to be any surface-to-air missiles, but...
An RPG or something?
Yeah, I just thought, let's get some altitude,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and get away, get out over the ocean. And... we did, and we flew to Okinawa, and I think they had soft drinks on the plane. It was a DC-8. I don't think I said that, though.
Tell me about the stewardesses. You mentioned them and that you thought they were pretty brave.
Yeah. Well, the whole crew, I think they must have paid them extra. You know, I can't imagine that they'd take those flights. They got a lot of volunteers to come in there just then. And I was told they had some kind of rule where they could only be on the ground. They had to be on the ground less than a half hour, which meant unload, load back up, don't refuel. And it was a government contract of some kind.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember. I remember they were young. Back then, all the stewardesses were young. Now, with the age discrimination and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. everybody, there's all different shapes and sizes and ages of stewardesses these days.
It's interesting you say that they were young because you were very young too, Tom.
Yeah. Well, they were, I'm looking back, you know.
I know.
They were probably my age. You know?
Probably.
Yeah, I had just turned 23.
Yeah.
February 1st.
Yeah.
And we went and landed at Okinawa, and I think the air base there where we landed is named Kadena.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over to the Marine place by bus, and there were two camps over there, Camp Hansen, and there was a Camp Butler. I can't remember which one I was in. But I remember being surprised to find that there was a local middle-aged woman in the barracks when we went in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out, they told me, well, she takes care of any sewing, buttons, rank insignias, clean, you know, she and some other people clean the place. You don't have to do anything. I said, this sounds great. And I remember that we went to the NCO club, and there were cabs on the base. There were little cabs. So you pay them a quarter, they'd take you anywhere.
Now, are these cars?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
With local Okinawan people driving them.
Sure.
And they'd take you places. You want to go to the movie theater, if you had a quarter, they'd take you. They'd take you down to the NCO club. And I remember the first night there, we went to the NCO club. And I remember a couple of things about that. I was reasonably sober at the end. But I remember that the menu had numbers and that the waitresses didn't speak English. And they knew if you ordered a number one, or number two, or number three, that's all they knew. And if you didn't want lettuce on your number one, you were just out of luck.
Okay. Uh-huh.
You know. And they had a band that imitated American records. And they were really good at it. I remember that. And I remember that zombies, you know, those drinks where they mix everything together,
yes.
were a quarter. This was a recipe for a real problem.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Now, who did you go with?
I remember, I think Bob the cook and I and a fellow named Miller and several other guys that were on the flight, some from our unit, some not.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember too much about it. But I know that Miller went away to go to the restroom late in the evening and never came back. And we saw him the next day when the MPs dropped him off. So, as it turned out, he had gotten lost trying to go to the restroom, which you can imagine the condition he must have been in.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess he couldn't hold it any longer, and he went in an inappropriate place.
Okay.
I think it had something to do with the ice cube machine. So, he got arrested. So anyway, he came back the next day, and they basically let him off with a, you know, don't do that anymore, knowing in a couple of days he was going to be gone.
For sure, yeah.
And we were there about 3 days, and I remember the next day they called us all out for formation, and they said, anybody that wants to give blood, get in this line. Anybody that wants to go on a working party, get in this line. Well, I didn't much want to do either one, but I figured, well, since I'd had hepatitis when I was a kid, I'd get in the bloodline, and when I get up there, I'd tell the corpsman I had hepatitis. They wouldn't let me get blood, and I'd go back and go to sleep.
Right.
So that's what I did.
Is that how it worked out?
Yeah. I thought it was pretty clever, act. And I think we went to see a movie that night. I remember seeing the Blue Max on Okinawa. That's where I saw the Blue Max the first time, mm-hmm. with George Peppard and I can't remember who else. It was a good movie. And eventually we got new uniforms, and we got our rank insignia squared away, and we caught another Continental Airlines plane at Kadena. And this was another DC-8, stretch DC-8, I think they said it was. And we flew nonstop from Kadena to El Toro, California, which was a Marine Corps air station, which was just recently closed, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was right near San Juan Capistrano, you know, where the Swallows come back from, between San Diego and L.A., I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we landed there, and we got down, and they put us in some barracks, you know, the transient thing, gave us the stuff to make our racks with, and they didn't really bother us too much about, you know, still had the jungle boots on, not polished, and stuff like that. They didn't really get too hard on us about being real squared away.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was a 12-hour time difference, so we were ready to go to bed, and it was noontime. And we decided to stay up till that night to try to get the clock back in sync, you know.
Sure.
And we went over to the, for some reason, the first thing I did after that was get some change, and I called home. And I got my dad. My mom was actually at that time working on a master's degree at Miami of Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and she was in class. That must have been that night, because she said it was a night class. So it must have been later that evening when I finally got to the phone, because there were lines for the phones.
I believe. Yeah, absolutely.
And I talked to my dad and told him I was safe in California and everything was all right. And my mother says to this day that she was coming home from class when that phone call came, and she knew it. She says that she felt a sense of relief on the way home.
Before she had any idea that you had called?
Yeah, before she had any uh-huh. idea I had called.
Uh-huh.
And I asked her if she wanted to talk to you, and she didn't say no. Where was I? Okay, anyway. So then we went to, somehow we ended up at the PX getting our ribbons to put on our uniforms. And we had gotten a presidential unit citation, so we were all lining up to get one of those to put on our uniforms. I don't know why. But anyway.
Now, was that the battalion? Or
I'm not sure if that was the 12th Marines or if it was the whole 3rd Marine Division. I don't really know.
Okay.
We got something to eat. You know, we found out the Air Wing Chow's actually was better. You know, they had all newer stuff. And then the next day they put us on working parties. Oh, no, the next day we took a physical. A complete physical, because apparently they don't let you out unless you're healthy. You know, they make sure you're okay, and then they can release you.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a week or so, or five. 5 days or something for those results to come back. So you got these 5 days for them to do whatever they want with you. So we ended up on a working party, this other fellow and I, over in an air wing classroom building where we were supposed to put together desks. But we discovered that in this building there were simulators, you know, C-130, F-4, and all that. We spent all day looking inside these and sitting in the seats, you know, so I don't know how we got away with that, but it was a lot of fun, and I think we put together 2 desks. Yeah. But no one cared.
Right.
Then I think the next day, or maybe they did, because the next day we ended up washing windows at a mess hall. But those are the only 2 I remember. And at night we tried to go into town, whatever was around there. I can't remember much about it. I think about 5 days later they gave us the results of our physical and said, you know, come and get your orders tomorrow and you're done. So next morning we go down there for our orders, and this it was a woman lieutenant. I used to remember her name because she signed my papers to get out of the Marine Corps. I can't think of her name. But anyway, we found out from her that the fellow who was supposed to take the pictures for your IDs, the pink ID they give you for inactive reserve or whatever it is, wasn't there. He wasn't going to be there till this afternoon, mm-hmm. She said. So you can either wait around for the guy with the picture to take the pictures, or you can leave and just take your ID without a picture. They didn't care. Well, I don't think anybody waited for the picture.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah. So we got our pink ID and shook hands with the lieutenant, headed out. And at that time, I headed north to visit a girlfriend of mine in San Francisco or around there.
Mm-hmm.
And spent a week or so up there. Can't remember how long. And then I flew home. And I never saw that girl again either. But that's one of those things. But anyway.
Well, Tom, can you describe? I know that, you know, seeing someone familiar who was, you know, a friend would have been a great, you know, incentive,
yeah,
for you to get moving on out of the base. But I wonder what your mood was in general. Do you remember, euphoric or kind of
relaxed?
Relaxed.
Okay. Uh-huh. Relaxed and felt like I had, you know, done a hard job and I was finished. You know, that there's sort of a, when you complete a task, you know, that kind of feeling too, you know,
mm-hmm,
when something's over with and you've successfully completed it and you've got all your fingers and toes. And
did you have any specific recollection of how it felt to be back in the States, and once you walked out through the gates, the idea of basically being off the chain in a way? And able to do
well. I don't remember feeling anything but just that relief. I hadn't had a lot of interaction with civilians at that point. You know, we'd gotten off the base a couple of times to nightclubs, but or what passed for one.
Right.
And but I hadn't had a lot of, you know, mostly it was just the guys from the Marine Corps I was with.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember, it's funny you should mention that, I remember the first real interaction I had with a person, other than a military person, was when I landed at the Oakland airport, and I was waiting for this girlfriend of mine to pick me up.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy, you know, one of the baggage guys or the guys that gets cabs, you know, at the airport.
Right.
He was standing there. I started talking to him. Turned out he was from Dayton, Ohio, which is where I was born. And I talked to him for a while. He told me that California was God's country. He was glad he left Ohio. I remember that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was really the first. And other than the, you know, you still have to tip the people that carry your baggage. I realized that after I got home.
Right.
And I let them carry my baggage, too. I wasn't going to carry it anymore. But, yeah, I just felt relaxed, unburdened. And I was really glad that my parents were unburdened, and my brother. And nobody had to worry about me anymore.
When you arrived back in Ohio, can you tell me a little bit about how it was to see your folks again?
Yeah, my dad's family's from Dayton, so I flew into the Dayton airport, and in civvies. I didn't wear my uniform.
Right.
I had a sport coat on, as a matter of fact, that I purchased out in California. And my dad and his and my family and my dad's two sisters, and one of them had a son and a husband. They were there. My dad's brother and a couple of his kids and wife. And
they all came out to the airport?
Yeah, they all came out to welcome me home.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad brought the, or my brother, I guess, brought the new car that I had told him to order when I left, because I knew I had a job to go back to. So,
what kind of car was it?
It was a '68 Firebird 400.
Sweet.
Yeah. Maroon with black interior.
Nice. Yeah. You don't still have it, do you?
No, I wish I did.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that would work.
Yeah, before I went in, I had a '65 GTO. I wish I still had that.
Oh boy!
But anyway.
So they brought the car out too.
Yeah, and I drove the car home, and I guess we went home. We didn't stop in Dayton anywhere. We went home, and I went up into my room at my parents' house, and I think I picked up my guitar, which was I had bought a new guitar, and the thing kept not showing up and not showing up, because everybody was buying a guitar in the 60s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And right, like the day before I left for Vietnam, my guitar showed up, my new guitar. So it had been sitting there brand new until I got home. So I opened that up and played a little bit on that. And I probably slept a while and ate some food. You know, it was funny. My mom and my aunt used to send me cans of Chef Boyardee meatballs and spaghetti and ravioli and all that,
mm-hmm,
to supplement the diet, you know.
Sure.
Vitamin pills, all kinds of stuff. And we used to eat those cold, you know,
mm-hmm,
which was kind of odd, you know. We didn't have anything handy to heat them up. We just eat them.
Right. Just pop the lid and eat them.
Yeah. And I haven't had a can of Chef Boyardee since. It's just, it doesn't appeal to me.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing of it. But anyway, I think she had some for me when I got home. I said, no, I don't think I'll pass on that, because she figured I liked it. I did under the circumstances, but now I had better opportunities. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you talk to your dad, say, Dad, I need a steak or
yeah,
something like that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I craved lemonade again, like I did on R&R. It must have something to do with vitamin C, near as I can figure. But anyway, after a couple nights, I went out to one of the local hangouts to see if I'd run into anybody. And a couple days later, I went back to my old place of work to tell them, hey, I'm back, and you got to take me back.
Now, was it the insurance company?
Yeah.
All right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I set up to go to work as soon as possible. And I don't think that was a good idea.
I should have
taken more time off.
About how long until you did start back?
Oh, not more than 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe 10 days.
And you say that looking back, that probably wasn't a good idea.
Right.
Can you just explain why?
Well, I couldn't sit still, for one thing. I kept moving around. I was nervous. I don't know if it's nerves or whatever it was, but I'd sit behind a desk, just wasn't doing it right then. You know, I just had to move. I had to get up and move around. And, I was still not sleeping real well. My mother said you could walk past my room and I'd wake up. But I think I should have relaxed more, you know. Taking a little time to unwind. Because I think you don't realize it, but you're tense the whole time you're in Vietnam. You don't sleep as well as you do in the States, for sure, and you're on edge. It's not on edge so that you're nervous or shaky, but it's that you're alert is a better word for it. And it takes a while to get rid of that constant alertness, I think. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And so your first couple, 3 or 4, maybe even longer weeks at work were not so productive.
Well, I would say not. I got back into the swing of things pretty good, but I couldn't work nonstop. I had to get up, you know, move around, take a break, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
were you realizing, as it was going by, that you weren't kind of all right? I mean, you should have taken more time, or was it only later on?
Well, that was only later I realized that.
Uh-huh.
It was only later.
How did people treat you, Tom?
Pretty good overall, I think. The people I worked with, you got to remember, Southern Ohio is not a real radical area.
No, that's right. That's putting it mildly, yeah.
Yeah. And the people I worked with were fine, and there weren't a lot of questions. Some people I worked with were glad to see me home, you know, and I met some new people. The only time it really, and I tried to just forget about it, but it did come back because one of the guys was in a reserve unit in the medical unit in suburb of Cincinnati, and they got called up after I came home.
Is
I was
right?
there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I, you know, he was asking me a few questions after that. But so he went for a year and came back. But
was he more or less seeking your advice, or?
Yeah, he was just asking me what to expect and all that. But you know, I tried to tell him, you know, it really depends, you know, where you're going, where you end up, you know. And what you'll be doing. And I fell in with a couple guys. There was another fellow who had gone about the same time I did, who came back from the Army. And there was another fellow who had gotten out of the Navy recently, and then another guy. We sort of hung out together. We were the young programmers there, and we had a every day at lunch, we would play hearts. That's what we did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And kept a cumulative score. So, and we played to 1,000, you know. So it went day to day. When somebody would get ahead, the other people would gang up on him, you know. It was one of those things. We had We did that for a couple years, I think, or a year and a half, anyway, until we started leaving to go on to different jobs. But I got into the swing of things after a while. And I really didn't expect anybody to buy me beers or pat me on the back, really. I never felt like that at all.
Tom, let me ask you a couple of timeline questions. You're back at home in the spring of 68,
uh-huh.
And it was at that time that Dr. Martin Luther King was killed. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yes, I remember that, and Bobby Kennedy, too.
What do you remember, first of all, about King? Do you remember hearing about it?
Yeah, I remember seeing it or hearing about it on TV.
Uh-huh.
Thinking it was too bad, you know. But and I know guys who said things changed in our battery after I left, you know, after the Martin Luther King assassination.
Uh-huh. You mean relations between?
Yeah, relations between, because we had a couple black guys living with us in our tent or in our hooch at Dong Ha that there was never any problems in our battery along those lines, and I saw.
Right.
And but some guys said that things did become a little more distant after that. But I wasn't there then, so I don't know. But I remember that, and I remember thinking, geez, you know, that was really awful.
Did you have a good sense of who Dr. King was at that time? I mean, had you been paying attention before you went over?
Yeah, somewhat, mm-hmm. And I was not a really politically active or anything like that, but I knew who he was, and I knew that the nonviolent business was a good thing, you
sure.
know, and I didn't see any reason why some people should have to ride the back of the bus, you know. I never got that, you know.
Right.
Of course, you didn't see much of that in Ohio.
No, that's right. Although, there's you know, still frictions in the
yeah.
cities, no question.
Right, yeah, but there wasn't a rule that
no,
you couldn't
right.
go in the same restroom or you couldn't go in the ride in the same area of the bus. There wasn't any of that.
Sure, yeah. sure. What about when Robert Kennedy was killed? Any impressions or remembrance around that?
I remember it, and I remember thinking what was, you know, what was going on. You know, I didn't understand why. I wasn't a particular fan of his,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't understand somebody's motivation. It's not like he was dangerous or radical, or I didn't think, you know. And I found out later when he was a young lawyer, he was on McCarthy's staff.
Yes.
the Senator McCarthy and the Army McCarthy hearings, that guy?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was, that's right, he was a counsel to the,
yeah.
the committee. That's right.
Yeah. I remember that. But anyway, I didn't dislike him, and I really felt bad because that, you know, two brothers in the same family. You know,
sure.
That's basically what I was thinking at that time, and all those kids. You know.
Yeah. Were you paying attention much to the rest of that election year as it went on?
Tom, I remember Johnson saying he wasn't going to run.
Right.
And I paid some attention to it. But you know, not as much as I do these days. I'm a little more. I was young. Yeah. You know. I remember Humphrey and Nixon.
Were you attracted by either of their programs for the Vietnam conflict? I mean,
I did want to see it end, and I thought mm-hmm. Nixon seemed to have the idea to get it over with. Although I didn't, you know, neither one of those guys was really likable, I thought. you know how some guys are likable? Those guys are not likable.
I think that's probably fair. Let me ask a couple of other questions about this period of adjusting. Did you actually change jobs? Did you get out of the insurance company?
Yeah, I changed in 69. In April. In fact, the day I was supposed to start was the day the country took a day off for Eisenhower's funeral. So I started the next day.
And where did you start?
This was at Champion International. What was then called... 69. Champion Paper, I think. And then it became U.S. Plywood Champion Paper, and then Champion International. And it no longer exists. It was bought by another paper company. And they even moved the whole business out of Hamilton, Ohio, which is where it was. Closed the paper mills. And
do you know which company purchased them?
I think it might have been International Paper. Somebody in Memphis.
And what were you doing? What was your position?
I started out doing application programming, and then I became what they call a systems programmer, which has meant some other guys that took care of the computer software, the operating software, and fixing problems and making sure new equipment worked.
What kind of software system was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, they were IBM 370 hardware, and the software was something called OSMVT. It was right before the virtual operating systems came in. And I did that and performance monitoring on those machines. And stuff like that. Organized the disks so that... to cut the movement of the heads, you know, you organize the data. Since those mechanical operations of moving the heads back and forth are slow, you want to minimize that kind of stuff. And back then, that's what we did.
Did you have any problems adjusting to the changes of the technology? Because, I mean, this is a very interesting time period in software development and hardware development, too.
Yeah.
It wasn't unified like now. I mean, there were different systems, competing systems all over
the
place.
Yeah, I didn't have too much trouble, though. It's more trouble now than it is then.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, then I was a lot younger.
Oh, okay.
You could soak it right up. No, I didn't have much trouble. And I started going to school, too, by the way, then, at night.
Where did you go?
Xavier University.
Okay, in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I kept going there until I finished in my Bachelor of Arts in 73.
And was it in some kind of computer area?
No.
What was it in?
History. I liked history. And I'd already started my career. I figured, what do I need a degree for? I mean, what do I need a degree in that for?
Mm-hmm.
So I did something I liked.
That was very brave and sort of non-linear.
Yeah, well, they, you know, you'd be surprised. I know lots of guys that have degrees in non-computer stuff.
Crazy
stuff, you know, like art history or stuff like that's what they have. We used to say that's what they have data processing for places where history majors can work.
I'll remember that.
Yeah. Well, if you get a PhD, you can probably find a job.
Well, we can discuss that later.
Yeah.
The status that you had as a Vietnam veteran, did it make any difference to you over this time period, the 70s, the early 70s?
No. I can only remember one small incident at Champion where a young girl who was a little radical hassle me about it, but that was minor. And we became friends. I didn't hold it against her.
Just just out of interest, what was the tenor of the exchange, and how did it come about? Do you remember?
Oh, I don't know. You know, they tell you not to talk politics at work now. It was probably a good plan.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember exactly how it came out, but something like... basically accusing me of murdering civilian children and stuff like that.
Do you remember, Tom, that whole Vietnam Veterans Against the War movement in the early 70s?
Just a little. I remember Jane Fonda and John Kerry. That's what I remember.
Do you actually remember them independently of everything that's going on?
Yeah.
What do you recall?
I just remembered I thought they went over the line. And it's one thing to disagree, but, you know, like Jane Fonda sitting on an anti-aircraft gun was a little over the top, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And and I thought, as I look back on it, Kerry was looking for a political career, I think. But, and I thought he was a little over the line. It doesn't mean that none of that stuff ever happened. You know, I mean, everybody knows that. When everybody has a gun, bad stuff happens sometimes.
But sure.
To say that it's policy and everybody does it, you know, that's just not right.
Did it make you feel any differently about your own service when you saw these kinds of protests? Either better that you had done what you had done and done so honorably, or like it was being cheapened, or anything like that?
I was glad that I was not in a position to where I had to see some of that. You know, I always wondered, what would I have done if I'd have seen somebody doing that? Would I have stopped them?
Would I have
turned them in? But I never was put in that position. I had no worries about me ever doing it. But there are other problems, too. You know, what if you see somebody? And I used to think about that sometimes, but I always felt that our guys had done the right thing and had done what they were supposed to do, and I can remember going out at Da Nang. I might have told you this. We went out on these med cap, they call them,
mm-hmm.
where one of these little trucks, a driver. Me is riding shotgun, a radio guy and a corpsman would go out to these local villages, and the corpsman would fix, you know, lance boils and fix hangnails, you know, I mean, you know, minor stuff for all the villagers. And that was my interaction with civilians for the most part.
How many times did you go?
Oh, maybe two or three. They alternated, you know, didn't send the same guy every time.
And did that strike you as a useful thing that American personnel were doing?
Yeah, I thought it was nice. And the people, the local people that I met there didn't seem to have a big axe to grind with us, you know. I mean, in fact, they were getting a lot of business, you know. They were setting up laundries and barbershops and stuff like that.
Sure.
Uh-huh. If you stay in one place long enough, the Vietnamese people are really... really hardworking. They see an opportunity, they move. I that's one thing I always admired about them.
Mm-hmm.
They're really hardworking, not afraid to work at all.
Can you tell me any of the med caps that you went on, about how far from base area would you go?
Oh,
any idea?
Just a few miles. Nothing more than that. Local villages, and I'm sure they picked them fairly carefully. I don't think they'd sent us anywhere where it was really dangerous with four guys, you know.
Sure, yeah. And you were providing security, it sounds like.
Yeah, I was like what they called riding shotgun.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the other guys had weapons too, but I was just an extra guy just in case, I guess.
Right. And did anything untoward ever happen on those missions?
No, they were without incident.
And you thought it was a good thing, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay. Tom, that makes me sort of think about the broader question, and this, if you could place it both when you first came back and then later on, you know, like now, essentially, how did you assess the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia generally? Did you think it was a noble attempt, or was it a kind of a policy that backfired, or something in between?
Yeah, that's funny you should say, use the word noble, because that a friend of mine who was over there at the same time in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
He was down at China Beach, and he said all it has left is its nobility. And he said there wasn't any oil, no gold. He said it was an attempt to help somebody in the beginning, and it wasn't very well executed. That's basically the way I feel about it. And the treaty, I guess we had a treaty there, didn't we? The CETO treaty, mm-hmm. Southeast Asian.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the way I felt about it. We weren't trying to steal anything. So, you know, what other reason was there? You know, I always thought that the idea was noble and the execution was flawed. And maybe the execution was impossible, given the... It's not like Korea. It's a peninsula, you know. We have water around you to protect you from infiltration. But because you had Laos and Cambodia and all those places up next to it,
mm-hmm.
it may have been impossible.
You know, of course, that revisionists, thinking back on the conflict, have said, well, you know, the United States should have done something similar to what's been done in Kuwait, now more recently in Iraq. Attack the capital city of the enemy, cut off the head of the administration, and hope that, and encourage the rest of the apparatus of the enemy to sort of fall apart.
Yeah.
Well, any thoughts on that?
Well, I always thought when I was there that it was really silly that they could come down and invade the South, but we could not invade on the ground, the North. We could bomb them, I guess, but... And I think it all had to do with the Chinese. I think they were afraid of the Chinese.
They meaning the U.S. administration?
Yeah. I think they didn't want... I think it was close enough to Korea that they remembered that the Chinese surprised everybody by coming across the border to the North Korea. And I think they were afraid of that. But I think we were basically playing defense.
Mm-hmm.
And what we could have done, I don't know. I don't know if that would have worked or not, but it's hard to imagine that it could have been worse. You know, there are 58,000 people killed over there. What if you'd have gone for the capital early? You know, maybe it had come to a head earlier. I just don't know. But 58,000 is a lot of dead kids.
Yes, and as you know, I mean, that's just the Americans.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Did you come across any of our allies when you were over there, Tom? I don't think we talked about that before.
Yeah, I saw some South Korean, and I met some Aussies.
What did you think of those guys, either group?
Well, the South Koreans, I just, you know, would pass them by. I never really talked to any of them, but they had a great reputation as hard fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea if that was deserved or not. I have no experience with them. The Aussies had those funny hats that we all liked.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few of them up at Dong Ha. I think maybe they were attached to the 12th Marines, but I'm not positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really talked to them either.
But when you saw them, you recognized them
mm-hmm.
as being Australian.
Yeah, they had this hat that folded up on
right,
the side.
The bush hats.
Yeah.
Yeah. but you never really sort of had any interactions with them either.
No, directly. No, mm-hmm. no, I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Did you form any kind of impression of our our South Vietnamese allies, and not speaking here of the civilians, but of the ARVN, the military structure?
Well, they seemed a little loose, not the ones I ran into.
How was that?
Well, for instance, when we were on the convoy going up north from Da Nang to Dong Hai, I remember we were stopped someplace. And a stopped convoy is always a target,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
So one of those South Vietnamese guys decided to shoot a chicken while we were all stopped there.
Mm-hmm.
And had everybody just diving all over the place for holes, and that didn't make much sense. Just to shoot a chicken while everybody's all tense, I remember one of our officers screaming at him, and I don't know if he understood a word he said, but they were just kind of hanging around, not really. And I'd see them riding motorbikes,
mm-hmm.
and wondering, well, what the hell are they doing, How come they're not out in the field someplace? But I've heard stories of good units that it had a lot to do with leadership, which I guess is true any time.
Mm-hmm.
If the leader of a unit was good, then the unit was good, or had a chance to be good anyway. But I never got the impression they were much interested, as long as somebody else was going to do it for them. Just
that,
a personal opinion.
Mm-hmm, sure. Did that seep into your thinking at all, or did you just kind of keep on with what you were doing?
No, I just kind of kept on.
Uh-huh.
I was just putting one foot in front of the other for 13 months.
Yes.
12 and a half, just trying to get through it and come home. I didn't do a lot of critical thinking, I don't think, while I was there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you may have spared yourself a lot of anxiety as a result.
Yeah, I tuned out quite a bit, I think. Mm-hmm. And maybe so. Maybe that made look for less stress. I'm not sure.
Tom, let me ask you a little bit about, again, the issue of being a Vietnam veteran. And here, I wonder if you have any view on whether the United States government over the years has put its best foot forward in terms of supporting veterans. Would you say that more resources ought to be devoted to veterans affairs? I'm thinking of health care, other opportunities for personal support or financial support. Or do you think there's a pretty good program in place, or is it somewhere in between?
Well, I really loved that GI Bill. I worked full-time and went to school and took GI Bill money and was able to put my wife through school,
mm-hmm.
at the same time. And I've always had jobs with benefits, so I haven't had a chance to use the medical facilities, so I don't know much about them. The Agent Orange thing, I was just told recently, I've got type 2 diabetes and have been watching my carbohydrates now, testing my blood to avoid taking medicine. I've lost 20 pounds. But they told me that's a presumptive Agent Orange cause.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I got to get a letter from my doctor and go turn that in and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So that'll be a new experience then, interfacing
with...
Yeah,
that'll be a new experience.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, Tom, being exposed to Agent Orange at all?
To tell you the truth, I never heard the word Agent Orange till many years later.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being sprayed by C-130s when we were at Da Nang. I thought that it was probably an insecticide for the mosquitoes. But now I wonder, because there wasn't a lot growing around there.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was all sand and there wasn't much green where we were, and I don't know if they were spraying something to keep it down or if that was insecticide. But I know on the map that places where we were show up on the Agent Orange map as having been sprayed. Mm-hmm. But I just don't know.
Can you describe, you said you remembered being sprayed. Do you know where you were or what you were doing? Can you call that back?
Yeah, I was in our place in Da Nang before we went up north. And I just remember being outside and seeing the C-130 come over with spray bars underneath it, just like a crop duster, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Only not quite as, didn't see quite as much stuff, you know. I guess it was more invisible. But I could smell it, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And that's why I thought it smelled like insecticide. But I just don't know.
Like that's, like, do you remember the smell? Like Mellifion, that kind of?
Yeah, maybe.
Something
DDT
like that?
Or,
uh-huh. Yeah. Do you remember it hitting you?
No, I don't remember feeling it.
Okay. Some guys have talked about that. They're, you know, they're walking along, they see the plane coming over, and they feel that hit them.
No, I never felt any.
Okay, but you smelled something, though.
Yeah.
Hmm. Do you have many friends who are Vietnam-era veterans?
A few, yeah.
Do you guys talk about, you know, the lasting effects, or, you know, interfacing with the VA or having to, you know, the diabetes issue?
Not too much, no. We meet once a year, on usually right around Veterans Day for lunch.
Now, these are local guys, not your reunion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just local guys. Guys I see sometimes, but we sort of celebrate Veterans Day.
I see.
And every once in a while we'll talk about it back then.
How did that get started, that lunch?
One of my friends did it, started it.
Uh-huh.
And we started calling other people and asking them to come over. We had five or six last time, I think.
Uh-huh.
And from different branches of the service.
But the thing you talk about is not necessarily your experiences over there?
Not too much. Sometimes we'll tell funny stories about it, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like the time up at Dong Ha when I ordered the Dixie Cups. Oh, did I tell you that before?
I don't think so.
Yeah. For some reason, the staff or the officers wanted some Dixie Cups. And I was working at supply, and they said, well, order up some. So I looked up the stuff. And to make a long story short, you filled out this requisition. And it would say, like, save two cases or, you know, whatever the unit of issue was for that particular item.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I got the unit of issue wrong. I thought it was each. So I ordered 1,000 Dixie Cups, I thought. Well, what I got was 1,000 cases of Dixie Cups. They came on the 5-ton truck.
I was going to say, did they actually deliver that?
Yeah, they unloaded a, somebody must, you know, I know those guys in Okinawa knew that wasn't right.
Right.
and they unloaded it with a forklift off this big pallet of it. But we used them for trading material.
I'll bet, uh-huh.
And it turned out all right. But another fellow, friend of mine, ordered chain and got the size wrong and got a chain that had to be unloaded with a forklift. It was big enough you could have tied up the Queen Mary with it.
Right, right.
If they order chain by the thickness of the link, not the length of the link. So when you order like a 3-inch links, it's 3-inch thick, you know.
Oh, man.
Steel. So that was another one. But anyway.
Well, Tom, let me ask whether you've given any thought to the work that you've done around organizing the reunions that you've gone to. Did you help organize them?
I organized the first two or three.
Now, what's the What's the unit that has the reunion that you helped organize?
Oh, the first 8-inch howitzer battery, which is what I was in.
Okay. And how many guys do you have on the contact list?
100 and some. 120 maybe.
And I know that you just went to the reunion this summer. Out here, was it in Las Vegas, I think?
Right.
And I know you drove all the way.
Yeah.
And all the way back.
Yeah.
Which is quite a haul. How many guys attended this year?
We had maybe 20. We were with another infantry unit this time, the reunion. And I'm not sure how many they had. They had another 30 or 40 maybe. And so we were all together, so we'd get a good price.
Now, was that infantry unit part of the 12th Marines as well?
No, 12th Marines is an artillery regiment.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
You know, 10th, 11th, 12th artillery.
Okay.
Uh-huh. 1 through 9 infantry.
So which infantry unit?
I think it was 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, or 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines. I can't remember.
Okay, that's okay. But you kind of clubbed up with them in order to get a better rate.
Better deal, right.
Okay. From the hotel. And were there any experiences that took place for you during the reunion that you can, you know, share with us here, or an impression of, you know, how the guys are doing?
Oh, I think our guys are doing okay. The infantry guys, I remember at the reunion, they read a list of their killed in action. They must have gone on for 5 minutes. And we just had a couple, you know. So I remember thinking, wow, glad I wasn't running around with those guys.
Yeah.
And but our guys are doing okay, and you know, some of them had some trouble afterwards with drugs or alcohol, but one of them that did is now a counselor, drug and alcohol counselor.
Is that right?
Counselor, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he's doing okay. And another one that did, wasn't at this reunion, but he works out in the forest up in Oregon or someplace, you know, for the government.
Mm-hmm.
He got the vote for being in the best shape because they weren't allowed to use power tools because it was government, you know, because of pollution. So they'd use hand tools to do all their trimming and everything to keep the paths open and cut down trees and stuff like that. This guy was in great shape.
That's hard work.
Yeah. But anyway, the ones that come to the reunion are doing okay. I suspect the ones that aren't doing okay aren't coming. That's my personal opinion. They can't afford it, or, you know.
Or it's too hard, or.
Yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tom, have you been to Washington, to the Wall, or to a traveling?
Yeah, I've been to the Wall, yeah. I went with my wife and kids many years ago. My kids were little.
What was that like for you?
I remember being impressed. That it was a very impressive sight, and all I didn't understand at that point what all the hoopla was about. It seemed fine to me, and I did look for some people I knew and took some pictures. It was a little emotional, but it would have been different had I been there with guys I'd served with. I was there with my family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you thought about, or do you have any interest in, returning to Vietnam at any point?
No.
Why is that?
Didn't leave anything there. There's nothing I had to go back and get. That's what no, I don't want to go back there. I know guys that have gone.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys at our reunion has been back twice.
No kidding.
Yeah. I just can't do it. You know, I just don't want to.
Did Did you ask him why he was going back, or was it clear why?
No, he just wanted to see all the places he'd been, you know, mm-hmm. see what had happened to him, I guess.
And there's nothing like that that's pulling at you?
No, not at this point.
Tom, is there anything that I perhaps haven't asked you about but that you would like to include in the interview?
Oh, no. Can't think of anything. Probably will after we hang up.
That's okay. We'll give you an opportunity to add to the interview at some stage if you like. But for now, let's take a break, and I want to thank you very much for participating, Tom. It's an important thing that you've done, and I really appreciate it.
Okay. Can we...
Go ahead, Tom. Let's go ahead and
there's
add
one thing that I wanted to mention that
sure.
I didn't find this out until a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
After my father was dead. My father died in 1986.
Okay.
My mother told me, just kind of off the cuff one day, you know, your father went to Mass every morning you were gone. And I said, and nobody told me that. You know, that's kind of significant, you know. And I never found out about it. I didn't know it. You know, he was once a week guy, you know, before that.
Mm-hmm.
When I went, he went every day to church.
The entire year you were gone?
Yeah, the entire year I was gone.
Now, let me just ask your brother, Tim, when did he was drafted, right? And he was in the Army.
Right, after I came home.
Okay. And when was he actually in Vietnam then?
No. Nope. He ended up being the culmination of his career was being the lifeguard at the dependent swimming pool at Sandia Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
That's sweet.
Yeah, and before that, he played softball on the 4th Army softball team, handed out basketballs at Fort Leonard Wood. It was a good deal.
That's incredible because he would have been drafted what in. 69 or?
Yeah, 68 or 69, yeah.
Wow. You never had a chance to talk to your dad?
Right.
About his conversation with God?
Yeah.
Did your mom tell you anything else about that?
No, she didn't. It made me a little sad because it meant that he was really worried. You know, I knew they were worried, but he was really worried.
Well, he had served in the Marine Corps himself.
Yeah, but he never saw combat, though.
Where was he?
He was like my brother. He was lucky. He was in the Marines during World War II, and I asked him what he did one day, and he said, once a week, I knocked out a sailor. And he was a boxer. He boxed and worked in Barstow, California, a supply depot. But he was in special services. Mm-hmm. He boxed.
As he remembered it then, he won every round. Is that what he was telling you?
Oh, he won every fight, he said.
Well, thanks for including that, Tom.
Okay.